During one extremely hostile meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party committee, they confronted me and said, "Will you give a blanket undertaking that you, as party leader and potentially prime minister, will automatically support any military action Israel undertakes?"
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 20th of June 2025. It's the calm down after Bilderberg, but wow, what a Bilderberg and a war. What a war. What a World War III. Don't believe a word we say, as we do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port, turned merchant venturer fortress now, where they own all the utilities, apparently, in Tampon Charlie's empire of lies. Also controlled by the City of London, of course, as I keep getting reminded. It's not just Tampon Charlie in charge, it's the city and the livery companies, the cults. I did an interview with the Reality Check Radio this week in New Zealand, where we got into a bit of depth on the medieval guilds. And, oh, of course, one of those was the Freemasons. So we're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or the Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. Easiest place to reach it is just underneath the big green download button at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentier, World War III, or wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, Iran, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted Armageddonist, accelerationist, upside-down, topsy-turvy policies crafted to make every crisis worse. So, yeah, we got a solution. Only thing is, it's not a solution at all. And the politicians have nothing to say. Well, we hope so. There will be some politicians with something to say this evening, we hope. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI, which is all depersonalised, isn't it? That's the idea, is get the human soul out of all decision-making. Or maybe even they want us dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they're interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, just like the jabs, of a doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. We're going to do things a little bit upside down this week, but we are going to have a little bit, hopefully, from Reform here in Bristol, Reform UK, the up-and-coming party that apparently are going to get a 44-seat majority of this election right now, general election. Plus, we'll also be hearing from John Wedger, the former Metropolitan Police detective, about this newly announced inquiry. Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel, and then Ofcom and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and then from People's Republic of Stokescroft by the trans lobby. Martin, we're going to do things a bit slightly back to front this week and start with Iran, because we're going to be going at 6 over to hopefully hear from Reform and look at some more of the national and local issues. What do you think is, why do you think, when we weren't quite, I think, aware, it was actually while we were on air last week, this time last Friday. I'm sure that's not why they decided to do it, to wrong footers. That was when the Iranians launched their retaliatory strikes against early Friday morning Israel's bombardment of the apparently just the nuclear sites, but also some assassinations over in Iran. Now, this is a war which has been expected for a long time. It's been being talked up by the Americans particularly and the Israelis.
Well, that's right. And eventually the day came. I mean, it's not something that's been unexpected in a sense, but of course they achieved tactical surprise, not least because the Iranians, very foolishly, were talking to Donald Trump and presumed that because they were talking to him, nothing would happen until that had been resolved. But in actual fact, they were double-crossed. So there you are.
Well, I mean, there are some that are saying that this is all actually the idea of this attack by Israel was to totally destroy those talks happening with the United States. But you don't think that they were really worthwhile anyway?
It's pretty obvious with hindsight that they weren't worthwhile. But I think the Iranians' leadership did what they had to do, which is, you know, for the sake of their own people and everybody else, they're trying to be reasonable. But it's very difficult to try to be reasonable with people who just take that as a sign of weakness and then threaten to kill you and actually kill you, the people that you're talking to. It's absolutely mafia-style stuff. And the downside for the Israelis and the Americans now is that nobody really is going to be prepared to do any deals with them if they can avoid it.
Well, let's go to Al Jazeera. And I was reading today that I think, isn't it, Ben-Gavir or Smotrich has said anybody that watches Al Jazeera is a terrorist. Have you seen that?
Well, they've been saying these kind of things all along, and they've been killing 18-month-old babies as terrorists. So there you are. Never mind saying they can't watch Al Jazeera. They're dead.
Right, well, Shahram Akbarzadeh is the director of the Middle East Studies Forum at Deakin University in Australia, and he's also a non-resident senior fellow with the Middle East Council on Global Affairs in Doha here, and joins me from Melbourne. Thank you very much.
I think this conflict is playing out exactly the way Netanyahu planned it. Everyone is responding to Netanyahu's plan. Netanyahu started the conflict to torpedo nuclear talks between Iran and the United States almost a week ago now, exactly a week ago. He would have known, and all observers would have known, that Iran would retaliate, and Netanyahu planned to use the retaliation by Iran to drag the United States into the conflict. Now, that seemed to really play according to his plan, because Trump was really sending signals that he was ready for the U.S. to step in and finish the job. It's only by the fact that a lot of European powers are really concerned and anxious about what this conflict would do to Europe, to the Middle East, globally, that now we perhaps see a pause in the U.S. decision and giving diplomacy a chance. So I think Netanyahu has been in the driver's seat from the very start, and there's a big risk that these negotiations will fail and we'll go back to where we were at the beginning of last week. United States is very much involved in the conflict. The Israeli military hardware is supplied by the United States. United States provides support in shooting down various Iranian missiles. So the U.S. is very much involved. The fact that Israel has not managed to destroy Fardo, a nuclear facility, is because that is a deep underground facility, and the only power that can hit the facility underground is the U.S., U.S. bombers. Earth-blasting power bombs. So Israel really wants the U.S. to be involved. And it's not just a matter of targeting the nuclear facilities. That's only the beginning of the story. The agenda for Netanyahu is regime change. And that's been made very clear, but explicitly, by various statements that Netanyahu has made and various suggestions that are made by hawks in the U.S. administration.
So are there any evidence that the Americans are preparing to bomb, whether cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, aircraft or anything like that, to join
in? Yes, because they've sent a load of relevant planes to Diego Garcia, and they've sent a load of refueling planes. So they're putting all of the pieces in place to do exactly that.
Aren't the American soldiers that are based mostly in Iraq, I think, aren't they vulnerable?
They are, yes, but they've been clearing people out of those bases for the last few days. And presumably they have got things like bomb shelters and what have you. But it is going to be a problem for them, because if they attack Iran, the Iranians are going to strike back at any US facilities within range. And they'll be looking to create massive casualties.
Well, it's a bit funny, isn't it? Because I haven't really heard this talked about much in the mainstream press. But the idea of Syria toppling is rather handy for the Israelis, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the reasons why they've gone ahead now.
Because they're right in between Israel and Iran.
Well, that's right. So the existence of the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, as they used to call it, and whatever you want to call it,
it was a government. It was an elected government.
Yes, indeed.
It was a secular elected government.
It was, yes, indeed. But the point is, by toppling Assad and changing the regime, Syria has now become a free fire zone for the Israelis. So they can just fly across Syria. They used to think I have to cross the Syrian air defence, so they didn't want to do that. But now they don't have to worry about that. They can just fly across
Syria. Which, of course, was beefed up by the Russians at the time.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So what's happened in Syria is almost like it was necessary for them to be able to do this.
That's right. There's an overall plan behind it all.
First of all, let's change the government from a secular one to an Al-Qaeda one.
Yes, because Al-Qaeda, as the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff are well aware, has always been a cat's paw for Western and Israeli intelligence. The ordinary punters in the West think Al-Qaeda is our enemy because they come and blow things up here. But in actual fact, even when they blow things up here, they're working for the intelligence services. Now, it's only fools like, you know, crazy people like tinfoil hat people like us that used to say things like that. But the reality now is the Chinese, Russian, Iranian general staffs all know that to be the case, and they're acting accordingly.
Yes, the Americans have been launching airstrikes in Somalia as well today.
Well,
are they practicing?
Well, no. This war is a general war which could easily engulf the whole planet. So Somalia is very much part of the same things that are going on. You know, it's part of what's going on.
So Somalia, how's that related?
Well, it's on the other side of the Red Sea and Bab el Mandeb from Yemen. So it's of crucial importance in the whole thing. And, of course, everybody's struggling to get control of Africa, to control resources, from the Western point of view, to keep the existing structures in place which allow them to extract, exploit Africa through international debt and the way in which they've created railway lines and so on, which only functions as export generators. And the Russians and the Chinese who are coming in and saying, well, let's just change all this and, you know, upgrade Africa and, you know, get it out from under US and British dominance. These are the whole struggle all over the world is about all of these things, and the Middle East is just one part.
I'm going to start doing almost like quite regularly, I'm not sure if I can manage to remember and do it, and if he keeps coming out with these amazing speeches, something from Ibrahim Traore each week on here, because he's very interesting, isn't he?
Yes, did you see, saying? I sent you a speech that he made from Jerry in Nicaragua.
So he's over in Nicaragua, wasn't
yes.
he? I know, well, just tell us about it, because I'm not sure if this is the one.
Oh, well, he sent me one, which I sent on to you as an email. I don't know if you saw it.
To Ibrahim?
No, Jerry sent me okay. one of Traore.
Who is Jerry?
He's a listener to our show.
Oh,
hello,
right, okay.
Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
He's a listener to our show. He's Irish, but he lives in Nicaragua. But he listens to our show.
Sounds nice. It's a sort of Bristol. Today's Bristol weather most of the year in Nicaragua.
Yes, it can get a bit too hot, I presume.
No such thing, apparently. But anyway, yeah, so lots of fan. You can sit under a fan, I suppose. But anyway, we're going to hear a bit from him a bit later on, from Traore, about their analysis of the Western press. It sounds frighteningly similar to the sort of things that we say. But before that, this time last week, as the London anti-war activists realised, gosh, the Israelis have struck Iran, that was early on Friday morning, there was an impromptu protest outside the Houses of Parliament by the coalition of anti-war people in London.
Beneath the shadow of Big Ben and the flutter of Palestinian and Iranian flags, Parliament Square has become a platform for fury and solidarity from a vast swathe of British society in the wake of what they call an unprovoked Israeli war on Iran.
I want peace in the region. I don't want war. So we're here to protest against the war against Iran. there's a very mixed spectrum of views among Jewish people, and me and the people who think like me, we disapprove of the war on Gaza, and we disapprove of Israeli expansionism into Syria and Lebanon, and we certainly disapprove of the bombing of Iran.
There is denunciation to go around for the British government, too, for not condemning the Israeli aggression and instead calling on Iran for restraint.
The government is calling restraint only on Iran. It's already typed Iran, against which it already has sanctions, as the enemy. It is not calling for anything commensurate with Netanyahu, to which it continues to offer logistic help, to offer arms parts, and to train their soldiers.
They know that this is on the edge of catastrophe. They've got no idea what to do about it, just as they didn't over Iraq or Libya or anywhere else. So they're frightened now. Of course, they do want restraint, but they don't want to do anything to seriously restrain Israel. And therefore, they're saying Iran's got to be restrained. Well, Iran will make its own decisions, but that's not going to happen.
As they chant, stop bombing Iran, end the genocide on Gaza, they say Iran is being targeted because of one reason.
Because Iran is the only power in the region that's openly and militarily not only just supporting the Palestinians, but opposing the U.S.-Israeli imperialism in the region. And this poses a huge threat to Israel because they know how powerful Iran can actually be and the power that Iran and the influence that Iran has already had in the region.
This is the second Iran solidarity demonstration in London in 48 hours.
This awakening that people have got, it's extremely important because this indicates that this is the beginning of the end. And I think there's another important thing that we need to realize. Iran in the recent history has never started the war, but it has always finished it.
As Israeli bombs continue to fall on Gaza, Lebanon, and now on Iran, voices calling for an international arms embargo on Israel continue to grow louder.
The message here is clear. Iran is not being bombed because it attacked anybody, but because it dared to support Palestinians. Support Palestine and you'll be bombed, and with Western backing. Saipur is a Press TV, London.
So that's from Press TV in London. He said one of the people there was saying it's the beginning of the end. But is it the beginning of the end of the punishment of the Palestinians? Or could this actually start something much bigger?
Well, you'd have to ask the person who said it what they meant by it.
Well, what do you think?
Well,
I'm asking you.
Quite possible that this could escalate to a nuclear war. It's quite possible the Israelis have nuclear weapons. Pakistan has already said if Israel uses nuclear weapons, they may retaliate. Because, of course, Pakistan is right next to Iran. And if Iran is attacked with nuclear weapons, that will definitely affect Pakistan. And so in order to deter the Israelis, they say, don't think about that because we will nuke you. Unfortunately, the Pakistanis don't have a clear way to deliver a nuclear weapon on Israel. But in any case...
Unfortunately? You mean fortunately?
No, I mean unfortunately, because we need to deter them. What should happen is the British commandos should go in there and get their nuclear weapons, and we should protect them from accuracy. We've got an airbase right there, and we could send people in from that airbase, get hold of those nuclear weapons to make sure the Israelis haven't got any, and that would stop all this nonsense, wouldn't it? Except that's not going to happen, is it?
Instead, what are we doing?
We are supporting the Israelis. And when the Americans, they're already refueling, and we've already been involved in this in attacks on Yemen. When they go to war with Iran, which will happen very shortly, we will join in. And then that Akrotiri base will definitely be in the front line. Everybody in there wearing a British military uniform is involved with the kid-killing Israelis. And we're on their side. Now, I'm not on their side, and you're not, but the British government is, and British armed forces are involved in this. They are legitimate targets. Of course they are.
So, what about nuclear weapons? Because there are some doubt over whether Iran actually has them, but we know, don't we, since the heroic efforts of Mordecai Vanunu back in the 1980s on the front page of the Sunday Times, revealing Israel's nuclear program.
Well, that's right. And, of course, Tulsi Gabbard advised Trump in March that all of the U.S. intelligence agencies, all of them, CIA, NSA, all of them, all said that Iran had no nuclear weapons and wasn't trying to develop them. This isn't really about Iran's nuclear weapons. If Iran had nuclear weapons, the Israelis wouldn't be doing this. This is about regime change in Iran so that the Chinese and the Russians and the BRICS are smashed, their plans for the world are smashed, and that's what it's all about.
No, it isn't. It's about Netanyahu's political survival.
That's at the micro level. At the macro level, it's something else.
Is it possible that just to keep someone like Netanyahu in power, he's prepared to start a major regional war, possibly even a world war?
Well, this is an interesting philosophical question, isn't it, Tony? It's the great man theory of history or the great bad man theory of history. There's some of that. A lot of things are accidental. You know, it's just a little accidental, you know, flick of the butterfly's wing.
He seems to have dug himself into a bit of painted himself into a bit of a corner, doesn't he? Because soon as he's out of power, there's going to be moves in Israel to prosecute him and most likely jail him for corruption.
Well, interestingly enough, do you know what he did last week? He flew to Akrotiri. Now, we are actually signatories to the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court.
Can't he do
so
a
when
Zoom
he landed
call?
In on our airbase, we should have arrested him, shouldn't we? And handed him over to The Hague. We didn't do that. Why not?
Why didn't he just do a Zoom call? Why does he have to fly to Akrotiri?
Well, in actual fact, I think he's a bit of a coward, Tony. Because it could easily be, if there's going to be decapitation strikes, who's on the top of the list for a decapitation strike, would you think?
Well, actually, that's not what the Iranians, the Russians, etc. like to do. They don't do that sort of thing.
It wouldn't have to be them, would it?
Well, who then?
Somebody. Anybody. Gavril Princip, yeah?
Who's he?
The guy who killed Falkshuth Ferdinand, yeah. He acted alone in the end.
Did he really? No.
No, he didn't.
Of course he didn't.
But I'm just saying that, you know, people like Netanyahu, their card is marked. Now, they're either going to be prosecuted or they're going to be killed.
Yeah, so it does seem to me that his only option, really, is to escalate this more and more, possibly even to world war.
Yes, that's true, and that's a complicating factor.
Well, what do you say about this big bad man of history theory? What is all that all about?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, the whole thing, World War II was just caused by Hitler, who had psychological problems. There was actually other things at work, you know, the German states, Sonderweg or...
Well, there was a very similar movement behind them, wasn't there, which is this very nationalistic, mythological sort of dream of actually a master race. The Zionists definitely see themselves as superior human beings to, say, for example, the Palestinians.
Well, as Ukrainian nationalists see themselves as superior to the subhuman Russians. And as plenty of English people see themselves as rather superior to lots of other people. Not us, but loads of people do, Tony.
Anyway, the Netanyahu does have a button. I'm not sure if his finger is hovering over in it. And this was discussed on Al Jazeera the other day.
Dan Smith is the director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He joins us now from Stockholm.
Personally speaking, I would be really surprised and shocked if Israel were to use nuclear weapons in anything except what it regarded as the context of existential threat. Mm. And that's what I think it developed its nuclear weapons for. That, I think, is what it has had in its mind all along. And that's why it's been prepared to be pretty extreme. I mean, the secrecy, the complete breaking of international norms around nuclear proliferation. I mean, think about the sanctions pressure that was put on North Korea. I mean, Israel has been prepared to really just, you know, buck the norm with that. And the treatment of Mordecai Vanunu, whom you mentioned in the course of the report, 18 years in prison for telling the truth, and 11 years of that 18 years were spent in solitary confinement. And when he was released, it was on probation on the condition that he did not talk to a journalist. And when he did, he was back in prison again for 6 months. So, I mean, they've been really, really serious about that program and about maintaining it. And I think my view of that is that it is for existential purposes, and it's only at the extreme that they would.
Well, he thinks they'll only use them in extremis. Sheldon Adelson is dead now. He openly said, we should use nuclear weapons on Iran and get rid of Iran by a nuclear attack. And he was a big funder of Trump in his first term, and his wife was the biggest funder of Trump in the second term. And they've said that, why don't we just do that? So the idea that nobody would ever use them, I mean,
this is surely, Martin, this is saber rattling. They don't actually intend to start a world war.
Well, hang on. Saber rattling is means you are going to get the saber out. Yeah,
when saber is you're rattling a saber, saying, "Hey, you do what I say because look what I've got behind my back."
Yes, and that's exactly what Gevier, I think, or Smotrich said this week. Was that there's some hard times ahead because they're taking some licks now from the other side. But I asked people to remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's what he said.
So that is a threat.
That is a threat to
the. But I mean, what we're hearing all over the place is everything about Iran's nuclear weapons. So the BBC did something actually quite good earlier this week.
Benjamin Netanyahu's warnings about Iran go back a long way.
Time is running out. They hope we'll reach the eastern seaboard of the United States within 15 years. Weeks away from having the fissile material for an entire arsenal of nuclear bombs.
Last week, there was a similar message.
Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in a very short time. It could be a year, it could be within a few months, less than a year.
But there are questions about whether that's the case. Israel says it's targeted two of Iran's nuclear facilities, Natanz and Isfahan. It hasn't said if it's targeted another called Fordo. And Iran acknowledges that Fordo and Natanz produce enriched uranium, which can be used in power plants and nuclear weapons. Iran, though, says its nuclear program is peaceful. On this, the global nuclear watchdog has raised concerns about the growth of Iran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium. And it says it can't verify Iran's intentions are entirely peaceful because of a lack of cooperation. But it found no proof of a systematic effort to move into a nuclear weapon. Or there's the US. In March, its Director of National Intelligence said the US continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. But on that, President Trump has now said this.
I don't care what she said, I think they were very close to having it.
He gave no evidence to support that claim. And all of this follows the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the US, the UK, and others. In return for sanctions relief, Iran agreed to limit its enrichment of uranium to civilian purposes. But in 2018, President Trump pulled the US out of the deal, calling it disastrous. US sanctions returned, and Iran, which had stuck to the terms of the deal, began to breach them. And that's continued.
Since then, Iran has significantly increased the number of centrifuges it operates to enrich uranium. It has significantly increased its stockpiles of uranium.
For its part, Israel is widely believed to have nuclear weapons, though it refuses to confirm or deny this and hasn't signed the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And as we watch this conflict, we know of Iran's threats and hostility towards Israel, that it doesn't recognize its right to exist. And we know Israel wants regime change in Iran. But Israel's justification for these attacks is that it faces an imminent and existential threat from Iran's nuclear program. So far, that doesn't match publicly available evidence or expert assessments.
Well, it's quite nice to see BBC verify, just saying, well, basically Netanyahu's making it up.
He is, but it doesn't really matter, because as long as Trump believes what Netanyahu says, he makes the decision. So Tulsi Gabbard, people like, she was... you know, put into his regime, let's call it the Trump regime, as a kind of window dressing that he was going to listen to people who were critical of US foreign policy. But he's now decided that, yeah, she can sit there and pretend to tell me things, but I can just ignore her, which is what he's doing.
Yeah, so he's saying basically that he doesn't really believe her.
He doesn't believe his own intelligence services, because she was just telling him.
Yeah, so this is all
of them were telling,
this is all starting to smell a little bit like Iraq.
Well, yes, it's very similar to Iraq,
WMD,
but more dangerous.
A WMD. Isn't nuclear, aren't nuclear weapons WMD? We are so worried about these WMD. At least they're not saying they've got them. They're saying they're about to get them.
Well, indeed. So it's a rerun of that tired old playbook. And they never get tired of playing it, because I suppose there's a whole new generation that didn't hear it the first time round. And in any case, the old tunes are the best, aren't they?
Well, back in 2003, we had Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, who resigned over that. So let's have a listen to his speech so we can compare then and now.
Iraq's military strength is now less than half its size at the time of the last Gulf War. Ironically, it is only because Iraq's military forces are so weak that we can even contemplate its invasion. Some advocates of conflict claim his forces are now so weak, so demoralized, so badly equipped, that the war will be over in a few days. Mr. Speaker, we cannot base our military strategy on the assumption that Saddam is weak, and at the same time justify preemptive action on the claim that he is a threat. Iraq probably has no weapons of mass destruction in the commonly understood sense of the term, namely a credible device capable of being delivered against a strategic city target. It probably does still have biological toxins and battlefield chemical munitions, but it's had them since the 1980s, when US companies sold Saddam anthrax agents and the then British government approved chemical and munitions factories. Why is it now so urgent that we should take military action to disarm a military capacity that has been there for 20 years and which we helped to create? Why is it necessary to resort to war this week while Saddam's ambition to complete his weapons program is blocked by the presence of UN inspectors? Only a couple of weeks ago, Hans Blix told the Security Council that the key remaining disarmament tasks could be completed within months. I've heard it said that Iraq has not had months, but 12 years in which to complete disarmament, and our patience is exhausted. Yet it is over 30 years since Resolution 242 called on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. We don't express the same impatience with the persistent refusal of Israel to comply. I welcome the strong personal commitment the Prime Minister has given to Middle East peace. But Britain's positive role in the Middle East does not redress the strong sense of injustice throughout the Muslim world at what they see as one rule for the allies of the US and another rule for the rest. Nor is our credibility helped by the appearance that our partners in Washington are less interested in disarmament than they are in regime change in Iraq. And that explains why any evidence that inspections may be showing progress is greeted in Washington not with satisfaction, but with consternation, because it reduces the case for war.
So that's former Foreign Secretary, who died on Ben Stack in very mysterious circumstances a few years after that, Robin Cook, speaking in 2003. Very, very similar situation. Absolutely, almost identical, where you've got this, oh, we need to disarm Saddam. Actually, of course, what they really wanted, and exactly what the United States wants right now, and Netanyahu in Iran, as you just said, Martin, is regime change, really.
That's right.
It's none of their business, is it really, who runs the country?
Well, they think it is.
They don't like us, so we're going to try and... well, this is some sort of US hegemony, Israeli hegemony. The idea is that you have to be controlled by us or you die.
That's right. And is it, you know, the spiritual leader of Iran has been threatened. We know where he is. We're not going to kill him yet, but we will. Because Netanyahu's called him the new Hitler, who must die. His existence must end. And of course, people who are saying things like that, they do realise the way it works. That means that comes back. Anything you say like that, that could be said of you, couldn't it? You are the problem. And as Stalin said, no person, no problem, Netanyahu. Yeah?
So, it's not really about what they're saying it's about. This is very similar, isn't it, to Scott Ritter and his statements around in 2003 when he was saying they're setting the intelligence around the policy.
That's right, yep. And he came to speak at Bristol University a couple of years later, very good speech, because, of course, he was involved in the whole thing. It's great. He was speaking to these Bristol University students. He said, you know, when I was a UN weapons inspector, and they're all nodding, well, you know, I wasn't really a UN weapons inspector. I was working for somebody else. Guess who I was working for, kids? The CIA. I was not really a UN person at all. I was a spy.
So these negotiators negotiating from the United States over the weapons program with Iran right now, or up until last week, they're probably CIA too, are they?
Right, quite well. They'll be talking to the CIA. What the Iranians suspect, and it looks as if it's true, is that a lot of their senior nuclear scientists have been assassinated. They've been able to be fingered because they cooperated with the IAEA. And they're now not going to do that anymore. So one result of all of this may well be, and this is a bit paradoxical, is that the Iranians, if they were to kill Khatami, he's the one who issued the fatwa against nuclear weapons, so that will be out of the way. Ooh. And then they have got the capability to develop nuclear weapons. And then the obvious conclusion, if I was an Iranian military leader, say, we need nuclear weapons, so let's get them.
The time has come.
The time has come.
You can hear those centrifuges spinning away, you know. And, of course, this seems to be much of the attack. It's not just about the survival of Netanyahu politically in Israel. It's also about forcing the Iranians' hand to actually develop nukes. But, look, before we get away from 2003... let's have a listen to Claire Short, who was International Development Secretary, who resigned a few weeks, I think, after Robin Cook from the cabinet over the illegal war in Iraq.
What she did was very, very unfortunate. She voted for the war.
Ooh.
And then regretted it. But if she hadn't voted for the war, what would have happened is that the majority of the Labour Party would have voted against the war. But Blair would still have had the war with the support of the Tories.
Well, look, Parliament is sitting. Why can't we have a vote today? Why?
Well, the SNP and the Greens are saying exactly that. Before we go to war, we want a vote in Parliament.
And before we go to Akrotiri to meet with Netanyahu and help him with all the intelligence for his, not only his genocide now, but his war on Syria, his war on Lebanon, and his war on Iran, surely we should have a vote to decide if the British people and the British government and the Treasury are going to support this.
Well, indeed, and that's what, of course, frustrated Cameron's attempt to go to war with Syria when Ed Miliband demanded a
support
vote.
Support this war crime. I mean,
well, yes, I mean, he came to our base the other day, and in actual fact, you could argue he was on British sovereign territory. He should have been arrested.
He most certainly should. Right. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Claire Short, and this is on the BBC PM programme, where they also played a little clip, another clip from that Robin Cook speech. I don't think quite such a good one as I had, though.
Well, let's hope America stays out of it, which is possible, and that would be good for everybody. And Britain shouldn't even contemplate joining it. I mean, this is the craven Britain that just goes anywhere America wants. What is this to do with Britain? Why should we be engaged? Israel started this war. Israel has nuclear weapons. Israel is taking land from Syria, is in Lebanon, is starving and killing people in Gaza. How can we possibly support Israel? I mean, the line must be drawn, and international law says this is not right. There's been a call from the UN. I'm hopeful. I think Starmer made an appeal for America to think twice, and there are these talks in Europe tomorrow. I think he would be crazy, Starmer. The Labour coalition, the voting coalition, is already under strain. He would lose big chunks of Labour's vote.
I mean, you couldn't
apart
have,
from doing the wrong thing.
You couldn't have been clear in your view, and you actually think it would be shattering for the Labour Party, for the Labour government, if they went along with, say, adding token forces to anything the US were doing.
If you remember, after Israel bombed and killed Hania when he was in Tehran, and he was one of the most trying to get a deal, Hamas spokespeople, Iran had to reciprocate, obviously, because they were humiliated by that, and Britain joined in defending Israel after Iran attacked. So we've been there before, quite recently, but we shouldn't engage ourselves. What the point of Britain's role in the world ought to be to prevent war, to uphold international law, not to just always go with America and indeed Israel in causing more and more chaos in the Middle East. And the other thing is, if Iran is defeated, I mean, you won't destroy the country. This is 90 million people in a very old civilization. But the chances then of Iran having a nuclear weapon, and everyone is clear that they are not there yet. Indeed, Tulsi Gabbard, the head of the US intelligence agency, has said they're not. But if they're going to try and destroy the country, then that's the only thing left for them.
So that's the former International Development Secretary, Claire Short, veteran of the Iraq war shenanigans and the vote, as Martin was saying, she voted for it. And then afterwards she resigned, which is a bit of a messy way to do things. But anyway, Claire, they're making it absolutely clear, Martin, that this is not what Britain should be doing at all. In fact, we're doing the opposite of what we should be doing.
Well, that's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because I think public opinion is pretty clear that we don't approve of what's going on in Gaza. Most people think that Netanyahu should probably go to the criminal court. I mean, they've just done an opinion poll. You know, if he came to Britain, he should be handed over to the Hague. Meanwhile, all the major...
But hang on, it's never mind an opinion poll. This is the law.
It is the law, but I'm just saying about public opinion in Britain. What will be interesting about this is Keir Starmer, Kenny Badenoch, and the blessed Nigel will all be in favour of war.
Well, are you sure about that?
We'll see, won't we?
Well, you're not sure about that, then.
No, okay. Well, let's find out.
Well, let's see the cup as half full, because actually there is quite a lot of movement in Britain, in the political circles, against Israel at the moment.
There is. So, in other words, it's going to be very... To keep the Americans happy, though, we're going to have to join in. And, of course, we've just done a trade deal, not a deal, it's a tariff deal with them, where they're only going to put 10% on our cars instead of 25%. That's supposedly a result. But maybe if we were to get a bit artsy about things, then maybe they would cancel that.
So Claire Short's talking about the 90 million population of Iran, quite well spread across, you know, compared to somewhere like Britain. It's far, far bigger. So the density of population isn't so high. And Tucker Carlson spoke to Ted Cruz, who is the Republican, I think, is it Florida senator? I'm not sure. No, Texas senator, isn't he? Who is the big cheerleader for Israel in Congress. And so let's have a little listen. It's actually a fascinating conversation, because they get right into the Tucker really presses him on the logic of his Christian Zionism, and maybe we'll hear, if we have time, a clip of that later, where he says, well, it says he who blesses Israel will be blessed, he who curses Israel will be cursed, this bit from the Old Testament. And he says, so you're saying that that applies to Netanyahu now and not to the Jewish people in Old Testament times. So can you just explain why it should apply now and not then, or then and now too? But anyway, it's a fascinating chat. But anyway, the most important, I think, political part of it is where where Tucker Carlson actually presses him on what he actually knows about Iran. He's obviously, you know, very, very keen to get rid of the Iranians. But anyway, so let's just have a little dip for 4 minutes into that 2-hour conversation with Tucker Carlson, who's still doing great stuff, even though, of course, Rupert Murdoch has booted him off Fox News.
Nations in war generally refrain from attacking and killing heads of state. Now, the Ayatollah doesn't. He's trying to kill Trump. We talked about that.
But we shouldn't punish him for it.
Look, there has been a long-standing nations in war have refrained from killing heads of state. I have not publicly called for killing the Ayatollah. What I've called for is doing whatever is necessary to stop him from getting nuclear weapons. In the first Trump term, what that meant was maximum pressure. So in the first Trump term, I spent a lot of time urging the president to withdraw from the disastrous Iranian nuclear deal that Obama had. President Trump agreed with me. He did that. And then I urged him to end the oil waivers and to sanction the hell out of the country. And it ended up crippling their economy. So Iran at the time was selling 2 million barrels of oil a day. 1 million barrels of oil a day. When President Trump ended the oil waivers, it cut their sales to 300,000 barrels a day. At the end of the Trump term, the Iranian economy was in shambles. They had massive inflation. I think the regime was teetering. I think it might have fallen. I would use economic sanctions and I would use moral suasion to try to effectuate the regime change.
Okay, so you topple the regime and by whatever means, what happens then? How many people live in Iran, by the way?
I don't know the population.
At all?
No, I don't know the population.
You don't know the population of the country you seek to topple?
How many people live in Iran?
92 million.
Okay. Yeah.
How could you not know that?
I don't sit around memorizing population tables.
Well, it's kind of relevant because you're calling for the overthrow of the government.
Why is it relevant whether it's 90 million or 80 million or 100 million? Why is that relevant?
Because if you don't know anything about the country...
I didn't say I don't know anything about
the country. Okay, what's the ethnic mix of Iran?
They are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay,
you don't know anything about Iran. So,
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government.
You don't know anything
about the country.
No, you don't know anything about the country. You're the one who claims they're not trying to murder Donald Trump.
You're the one who can't figure out if it was a good idea to kill General Soleimani,
and you said it was bad.
You don't believe they're trying to murder Trump.
Yes, I do.
Because you're not calling for military strikes against them in retaliation. And if you really believe that.
We're carrying out military strikes today.
You said Israel was.
Right, with our help. I said we. Israel is leading them, but we're supporting them.
Well, you're breaking news here, because the U.S. government last night denied, the National Security Council spokesman Alex Pfeiffer denied, on behalf of Trump, that we were acting on Israel's behalf in any offensive capacity.
No, we're not bombing them. Israel's bombing them.
You just said we were.
We are supporting
this is
Israel.
High stakes. You're a senator. If you're saying the United States government is at war with Iran right now, people are listening.
Okay, we are not bombing them.
Oh, okay.
Israel is bombing them. And, hey, why do you do the snide? Oh, okay.
What do you mean? Because this is super high stakes stuff. This is a huge country that borders a lot of other important countries. All the world's energy comes from there.
So you don't want another disaster.
You don't want to be
Tucker,
reckless.
The Ayatollah refers to Israel as the little Satan and America as the great Satan. Do you believe him? When he says it's the great Satan,
do you think
if the Ayatollah could murder both of us right now that he would? I do. I believe him.
Okay. I assume no good faith on the part of the Ayatollah.
No, it's not good faith. It's not good faith. It's that...
Just saying, you're a lawmaker. You're a powerful person in Washington. This is the most powerful country in the world. If you're calling for toppling a government, it's incumbent on you to know something about the country and to think through the consequences of that. And you haven't, and you don't. And I'm saying that's reckless.
You engage in reckless rhetoric with no facts. And to be clear,
I'm not calling for the overthrow of a government.
You put out a newsletter attacking Donald Trump and calling him complicit.
I've never attacked Donald Trump.
Yes, you have. And by the way,
I campaigned for Donald Trump.
Okay, yes.
And this is after anti-Semitism, this is the last refuge. You're an anti-Semite and you hate Trump.
Okay,
I love Trump.
I will read. You put out a whole newsletter saying Trump has abandoned America First. And here's what Trump said in response. Well, considering that I'm the one that developed America First, and considering that the term wasn't used until I came along, I think I'm the one who decides that. For those people who say they want peace, you can't have peace if Iran has a nuclear weapon. So for all of those wonderful people who don't want to do anything about Iran having a nuclear weapon, that's not peace.
Well, the level of delusion there is extraordinary, isn't it? They live in a kind of an echo chamber of views. It's quite clear 60%, I think, of US people do not want to go to war with Iran, the latest opinion poll.
But I mean, what Tucker is exposing there is the ignorance of this guy. He doesn't know the ethnic mix. He doesn't know the population of Iran. He just knows to hate it. And that's, it seems to be what's driving them, just a hatred. And this is the pattern, isn't it, of the Western alliance over the last few decades. Such and such has to go. Such and such. Now it's the Ayatollah that has to go. Whether it's Gaddafi in Libya, whether it's Assad in Syria, whether it's Putin in Russia, all these people have to go. We must have regime change. It's like a weird mantra. They just keep chanting it again and again. And now we're getting to the point where it could be a massive regional war in the Middle East.
A regional war. It could be a global war. If the Russians and the Chinese have sent electronic spy ships in there. Okay? There could be surprises. The Pakistani military have said that they will potentially use nuclear weapons.
But I think it was quite good. Tucker Carlson did rather expose that the guy doesn't really know his facts. He's cheerleading for a war, which he doesn't know anything much about Iran.
Well, that's right. But what you've got in the US is, I think, the chap there whose name now escapes me.
Ted Cruz.
I think he took $1.9 million from AIPAC. For his
last there's campaign. A long section in there where Tucker Carlson
That's
really
right. So in other words,
on APAC.
The reason why he's saying these things is because he's basically on the payroll to say those things, and he doesn't need to know anything more than that, because that's all he needs to know, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so what about the other stuff they're talking about there, which is, you know, to what extent the the Americans than the, I mean, the Republicans in Congress, the Israelis. It seems to me that there's just a bunch of people who are mates who've just said, right, we're going to get this guy now. They seem to be acting like a sort of immature gang.
Yes, it's clear that's going on. I mean, as I say, it's not just the Republicans in the Congress, it's also the Democrats. So there's a small group of Democrats and some Republicans who said, well, maybe, for example, we need to have a vote on this. Yeah. But the majority of the senators, Congress people are, you know, they're funded by Israeli lobbyists, and so they're very, you know, they just go along with what they're told to do.
So what do you make of Tucker Carlson? I mean, he's set off on almost like his own little mission, hasn't he, here, to call everyone to account. And if you have a look, I'm not sure what it's at now, millions and millions of views of that interview, more than we're getting on the BBC, because they're not interviewing people like, they're not employing intelligent interviewers like Tucker Carlson to interview the top people of the Israel lobby like Cruz.
Well, I think what's interesting, Tucker Carlson,
Piers Morgan is probably the nearest that we get in Britain.
Trump actually said, when he was told that Tucker Carlson was, opposing what he was doing, that, you know, that he should get on a proper TV show instead of, fiddling around on the internet. But of course, Carlson on the internet, now he's off Fox News, he's probably got a bigger following than he had when he was on Fox News. And of course, he can now say what he thinks, which makes, you know, a difference, surely.
It certainly does. So we're going to have a listen now to someone else who's been talking about Iran, and that is Loki. Thanks again to Mark for pointing this out. This is only from yesterday, where he's really spelling it out the way he sees it. He's the British singer.
First of all, I wanted to extend my salutations to Professor Morandi. You are a hero to us. We love you. We love the people of Iran. We are thankful, with all gratitude, to the Islamic Republic of Iran for what it has presented as a service to the entirety of humanity. With the move to defend itself against the Zionist genocide, colony, and US imperialism, it has placed itself at the forefront as the leader, not only of Islamic civilization today, but of the entirety of humanity. It is fighting on behalf of the billions across the world who cannot stomach to see another day when a child in Gaza is scrambling for food. It cannot bear to see another day of human beings decapitated and beheaded by savagery. Iran is defending civilization, and it is fighting back against the savage rule of genocidal regime like Israel and the United States, and we will forever be grateful. You see, they misunderstand something basically about Iran. They believe that its connection and its geopolitical role is linked to what they call interests. But actually, if they really understood the history of how the Islamic revolution came into fruition, the deep relationship which existed prior to the Islamic Revolution between those who launched it and the Palestinian organizations in Lebanon at the time. Of course, Abu Jihad Khalil Wazir, famous for being the head of intelligence for Fatah, one of the founders, is somebody that trained Iranians who later went on to launch the Islamic Revolution. And after that, Iran has supported, in a way that no other state in the world, materially, not emotionally, not symbolically, not diplomatically, not with NGOs, not with documentaries, materially supported the Palestinian resistance, all factions, even Fatah, after the period when they diverged politically from each other. You look at the example of the Carrion A ship, which was caught going into Gaza. Talal Naji, of the PFLP, who is currently imprisoned in Damascus by the Israeli-sponsored regime, once said that they knew about the Carrion A ship, but they didn't know about the 9 other ships that got into Gaza with arms from Iran for all of the Palestinian resistance factions. And that relationship has gone on throughout all of these decades. That is why Iran is targeted today. That is why Iranians are dying. That's why their children are being killed by Israel, because they have stood with the Palestinians and refused to let go of their hands. And that is an immense contribution to humanity. And also what they don't realize is they're not just dealing with a state, or even if they were to assume they were dealing with a war similar to the ones that they've waged on Gaza, on Lebanon, or on Yemen. No, they're dealing with a civilization thousands of years old, which a state has been built on top of it, which has a basis of resistance and anti-colonialism. There's a big difference when you are dealing with a state that has a long-term strategic comprehensive plan with China, investing billions into Iran. This is a completely different animal that Israel is actually shocked. Its own hubris. I saw the footage yesterday of Itamar Ben-Gvir being confronted by an Israeli saying to him, why did you do this? Why did you launch the attack on Iran? He said, we did not know. We did not know their missile capability. So this is the all-knowing Israel with its visual intelligence unit, 9900, or its telecommunications unit, 8200. They couldn't figure out the capability and the willingness to fight on the part of the Iranian people. And I would say there are two things happening which are very important. Number one, on the Iranian side, you have many groups and organizations who previously were basically campaigning to get rid of the government in what was an Israel-sponsored and US-sponsored regime change plan. Today, because of Israel's bombing, they are with the government more than they have ever been at any time previously. Now, what's happening on the other side? Mass demoralization of the Israeli society. You have to understand, the basis of the Zionist genocide of Palestine has been an inequality of arms. In order for Israel to exist the way it does with this social imbalance, it had to be massively, massively over-advantaged in terms of the monopoly on violence against Palestinians. And it's always sought to fight on that basis. And therefore, its population has grown used to that equation. It has grown used to, really, if they do military service, bullying some 80-year-old grandmas at checkpoints or operating drones and never getting near to the people they fight. When they have to kill people in Nablus, Arin al-Asud, when they killed some of these young men in Nablus, they literally just sent machine drones into the room with the individual where the drone killed the person. This is the type of military experience that they have. They have never been in a situation. Four generations of my family have had this view of Zionism and fighting Zionism as A, an important thing for them to do, but B, an almost invincible enemy. They could never have conceived of the visions that we have seen, of the scenes that we have seen over these last few days. And the Israelis themselves could not conceive of them. And so now we have a situation where if you are an Israeli today, you are very, very likely thinking of a second location to move to because you have the option. If you are an Iranian today, you are closer to your government and have more pride in your belonging than you have ever had before. Those are two contradictory motions which are pushing. Why is it that the Israeli government has to tell its citizens that they cannot leave the country? Because they fear the Algeria equation. They fear that because these people have other places to go, they will go there when this situation becomes as it is. Why is it that you have Israelis fleeing from the by sea to try and get out? Because their sense of belonging, their sense of safety is shaken, and their tolerance for a situation like this is extremely low because they've become used to a certain way of interacting with the rest of the world and with the region. And it is important to emphasize here that there are billions of people across the world who have been begging for some form of humanitarian intervention to stop what is happening in Gaza, for somebody to push back, for somebody to fight back, and Iran did. That is a position which will echo will echo through the centuries of time. It is not just that Iran has supported all of the resistance factions in a very modest way. And I don't mean modest in terms of number. I mean modest in terms of attitude. It was not something Iran boasted about. It was not something Iran expected thanks for or gratitude for or anything for or anything in return. But today, Iran has established clarity across the world. When all of your rulers were cowards, when all of your rulers were collaborators, when all of your rulers were traitors, Iran wasn't. Now, that is a position which will echo throughout time and people will feel those reverberations. The courage is contagious. And when people have seen this, they want to stand up to themselves. So this has been an incredible time to be alive, actually. And all of our hopes and prayers are with the Iranian people. May God keep them safe. May God protect them from all of the schemes of the enemies of humanity. And we really extend our, honestly, Professor Morandi has done such a great job at facing down some of the most extreme ghouls of Israel's propaganda war, from Piers Morgan to others. I was personally disgusted by the way he treated you several days ago. And so it's great to see you here in a more friendly environment, for sure.
Well, I think actually Piers Morgan does a reasonably good job. I mean, at least when he says something you don't like, that's actually the job of a journalist, to put the opposite point of view. So when he's interviewing some Iranian guy, Piers Morgan is going to be putting the opposite point of view. So it's a bit naughty of you, low-key, to say that, because he's grilling everybody. He's actually grilling quite well, as actually Nigel Farage was last week, the Israeli ambassador to London. So because a journalist asks a question you don't like, that's not on, I'm afraid. That's what their job is, to ask those opposing questions. But anyway, Martin, what do you make of Lowkey? His attitude there is very much pro-Iran. Iran is actually the only chance, really, for people in the Middle East, particularly for those in Gaza.
Well, I mean, he's obviously well known to those in the anti-war movement because he's been one of the, you know, prominent figures. And, of course, plenty of people do, after what's been going on in Gaza, have a great deal of sympathy for the Iranian
position. But is he right about that? Is that actually the only hope for people in Gaza? We've had a year and a half of people being killed there by the army, the IDF, and nothing seems to have changed, except that what Lowkey's saying is actually Iran is the only country that's actually doing anything.
Well, I can't speak for people who are not myself, but if I was a Palestinian, I would be thinking, well, this is our last chance because we've got nothing to lose here. Iranian missiles are capable of causing severe damage to the Israeli occupation forces. They need to, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not a pacifist. And, you know, they could be given the treatment the Ukrainian army's been given because they get used to doing the killing, but not too much
dying.
You
don't have to apologise for not being a pacifist because you do have a right of self-defence under international law. If someone starts attacking, indeed. In fact, in this street, if someone was to start attacking you, you have a right of self-defence.
Well, that's right.
In fact, you have a right, possibly, even to kill someone who's trying to attack you, depending on what the situation is.
Indeed.
So there is an argument for that, isn't there? Very much, you know, well, this is known in international law, actually.
International law is based on that principle, is it not? You're not supposed to aggress others, but if you aggress others, then they've got a right to self-defence. And that certainly includes occupied Palestine.
So we were talking about Scott Ritter a little bit earlier on. He's been very vocal about Trump's attempts to undermine Tulsi Gabbard and say, even though Tulsi Gabbard, Director of National Intelligence, has told me that there is no evidence that Iran have a nuclear weapon, I think I know better. And maybe he's been listening to briefings from Netanyahu, from Mossad, but the American intelligence community is telling him something different. So this is what Scott Ritter, the former weapons inspector and US Marine Corps colonel, and as Martin was just saying, CIA operative, back in 2003, had to say.
Tulsi Gabbard is the Director of National Intelligence is singularly responsible for this task. It is her duty, mandated by law, to brief the president. After all, she was the one who was ratified by the United States Senate. The United States Senate acting on behalf of the American people, said, we anoint you as the person responsible for this task. And yet the president says he doesn't care what she says. That means he doesn't care what the U.S. intelligence community is saying, which begs the question, whose information does he care about? We know that Israel has been making a case that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Is the president of the United States of America allowing the Israeli government, allowing Israeli intelligence to run an endgame around the director of national intelligence and brief the president directly? As an American, I would take umbrage at that very notion, that a foreign power has taken the lead in briefing the president of the United States on matters that pertain to war.
He's making a very clear case there, Martin. They're saying, actually, maybe this information is coming from somewhere else, not from the United States.
Well, it's clearly not coming from the United States intelligence agencies, because Tulsi Gabbard's job was, to do what Ray McGovern used to do, which is to get all the stuff from all the different intelligence agencies, CIA, NSA, whatever, and they're all clear that the Iranians are not developing a nuclear weapon. Trump basically put her in place in order to advise him, but he's ignoring her because, as you know, he's not under any obligation as far as he's concerned. He can make up his mind. He can ignore the whole of the intelligence apparatus if he wants to. So he is.
Right. Well, we're going to leave Iran for now and come a bit more down to earth. Joined by the chair of Reform UK here in Bristol, that's Richard Visick. Hi, nice to see you, Richard.
Yeah, nice to see you as well, Tim.
And I wonder how seriously you in Reform take these most recent polls that indicate that if there was a general election tomorrow, you would have quite a comfortable 40 to 50 seat majority.
Yeah, it does look very plausible at the moment. And at the moment, just by going around looking at the various council elections throughout the country, it has been very positive, which also backs that story up as well. Obviously, it looks promising also in Wales and Scotland with the recent election in Hamilton, which just shows that Reform have done pretty well there to squeeze on the SNP, and also coming up not far behind Labour there. I mean, Reform is 26.5, SNP 29, 28, so 1% in it between the leading party Labour. So it's very near even Scotland, in a place you'd never consider it. In the Runcorn by-election recently, that was a safe Labour seat. Reform did win it, admittedly, but with a small majority, but that was still an incredible situation. So Reform is taking it seriously, and indeed Reform supporters are. And as you know, the better that Reform does, the more people will take Reform as a proper party to vote for that has a genuine chance of not just winning in the north, but also in Essex, Lincolnshire, in fact, throughout the country.
You had your chairman resign the other week. 3 days later, he rejoined again. It sounds a bit shambolic, doesn't it? A bit amateurish.
Well, every party's got its resignations. I mean, today we've had Newby, the lady, the Commissioner for Treasury, resign, and the Labour Party over the disability fiasco in terms of the amount they're cutting back on that. So every party, and that's the party that's been going for much longer than Reform, the Tories have got their various issues as well. So that's part of a growing party. But then it was constructive because Zia Yusuf does resign. He comes back, he says he was very tired, and he takes on the role of policy and indeed the situation with Doge looking at the councils, etc. So that was a fairly comfortable arrangement there. So it doesn't seem much damage at all, quite frankly.
So have you been involved in politics before?
No, I haven't.
What's your background?
Me, I'm a lawyer. I have been involved in quietly campaigning, in the sense I take part in consultation papers for the government, in the UK government consultation papers. Anyone can take part in them. Not many people do take part, not paid or anything else. I'm a lawyer. But they do actually listen, believe it or not, and that's one of the things that Dave Cameron did help with, actually encouraging people to go down that road, and the government will actually look at consultation papers. So I cover a range of subjects, including family law as well, child maintenance system, various other areas of the economic policy.
So civil law, not criminal law?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So what is it about Reform that attracted you?
I think obviously one of the big attractions is it's a party that looks at the rights of the individual versus the state. The state has at times been, in order to protect the minority of, let's say, 5%, it really comes down so heavily on the 95% outside of that 5%. It's incredibly bureaucratic at the moment, the system. And whoever you are, whatever party you support, you quite often get a utility bill that's completely wrong or a tax demand that's wrong. Then you try and ring up the tax office and it takes ages to get through. And then if you, let's say, owe them money, you've got to pay them straight away. If you then are owed money back, they take weeks to pay you back, with many government institutions, including the council. So I think that the problem at the moment is that you've got the state versus the individual. There needs to be more protection for the individual.
Well, hang on, because Reform are interested in spending less on government and taxing less, etc. So that's actually going to just exacerbate that, isn't it? But it's going to be less money for Bristol City Council, for example, or HMRC to spend on people in call centres to help out people who owe tax or council tax or whatever.
Well, there's a few ways of dealing with them. For a start, let's say with tax, so everyone who's paying tax up to 20,000 would be completely exempt on personal taxation. So that's a whole layer of bureaucracy, and phone calls to the tax officer don't need to be made in the first place. And that again accords with various other parties, including the Workers' Party, for example, and others that see there's a benefit in actually giving less bureaucracy to people at that end of income. Helps with the poverty trap, indeed, in terms of benefits and social security payments as well. So that will help with the queues, etc. So there can be a situation where you can be less interventionist in certain individual rights and more intervention. In fact, if we look at Reform in some areas, they want to intervene more in government. For example, whether it's even thinking about the idea of, let's say, going back with coal furnaces in Wales and these steelworks. So there's an interventionist government in some ways as well, but obviously free market and many others as well.
What about some of the big hot-button issues that Reform is known for, that Nigel Farage is known for, about Brexit? Do you think there's actually been a Brexit?
Well, I think a lot of Reform supporters argue there haven't been, because Britain's still a member of the European Convention of Human Rights, is still on the Council of Europe, and obviously it's got the Human Rights Act, which brings that into force within the rules of English law. So, obviously, Reform wants that to be changed by effectively coming out of the ECHR, and indeed giving notice to the Secretary of the Council of Europe to come out of the arrangements in terms of the human rights.
Most of the human rights, isn't that a positive thing? That's about the only bit of law I can think of that I really like, is human rights.
I think there's a lot to be said with human rights, and obviously there's an argument, say, should there be a human rights code brought into this country just specifically for England, because, as you know, we don't have a constitution in this country. And that is something that can be looked at. But at the moment, as you know, the ECHR debate centres quite a lot with immigration. And that's obviously one of the problems we've got at the moment, where people are genuinely worried. When I go knocking on the doorsteps with other colleagues, it's quite clear that people have had enough about illegal immigration. They're fed up. It's a non-negotiable issue. And this, unfortunately, is the only way to come out, because otherwise, if we were trying to renegotiate the European Court, the ECHR, you need the actual agreement of all the other countries involved. Funnily enough, even the EU is not a member of the ECHR at the moment as we speak. So it just gives you what some of the complexities of the situation.
So have we left the European Union or not? Because there's quite a lot of people who are saying, well, actually, it doesn't seem like much has changed at all.
Well, I think in practice we have, in certain legal ways, but not fully. It looks like a sort of half-finished story to most people, and indeed that probably is the case. At the moment, when you've got a situation when you cannot remove asylum seekers that easily from this country, you need to go through to be able to combat any applications under human rights. So we aren't fully within a situation where we can say that we've left the EU completely.
Is assisted dying a human right?
Well, Reform has quite an open policy in terms of, I mean, Nigel Farage basically is someone who opposes the euthanasia or assisted dying. And one of the reasons, fun enough, is because of the ECHR, you know, if that suddenly could start legislating beyond, you know, we have judge-based rules that go beyond the framework of anything that's been passed today. So that's one area. But he did give a free vote to his other members in Parliament on that subject.
And what do you think?
It's something that I must say, everyone I speak to, and I'm pretty open-minded about it, from a religious perspective, every soul has a value. Obviously, I struggle with the point that even Nigel Farage made, which is a good one. You can have a situation where, you know, we're going now onto the issue of abortions with 22, yeah, up to 24, it can be abortions. Yet, if someone's rushed through premature at 22 weeks, they are sort of alive, aren't they? So it is a really difficult one. And I must say, I can't give an exact decision in my own mind, because it's something I can see both points of view on.
Well, and when you've just brought up abortion there, that's a bit of a hot one this week, isn't it, as well? Because they're now saying that there won't be criminal prosecutions of women that abort children right up to the time of birth. I mean, this is, it's almost like the moment of birth. Is it at the moment of birth that an embryo suddenly becomes a person and you can be done for murder or not before? I mean, it just seems to me that the envelope has been being pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed all this time, and not necessarily in a very, shall we say, human rights direction. An embryo is a human, and does it have no rights?
Well, as you say, that there's a lot of commentary on both sides on that, and a very, very hard one to make a decision. And then, to my mind, it would be, this is not private, based on these matters, they should be left as matters to referendum. I know referenda can cause problems, and but it's something that's personal to everyone, so it's very hard for me to make a judgment on that myself. Obviously, I can see the arguments, but also it's a really tough one.
So, I mean, it sounds to me like Reform UK is already shifting away from people voting with their conscience.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that obviously have very strong views in terms of their conscience and in the role of the state, and indeed how the UK reacts with its place in the world, obviously.
I mean, to me, it's a massively important business. Abortion is, you know, horrendous and horrific thing, and can actually have a really terrible effect, psychological effect, on a woman to have an abortion. And you know, for the, you know, difficult sometimes to think, well, maybe you should think twice about casual sex before you have the abortion, rather than just leave it to the last minute. There's such a lot of kind of almost like selling of this idea of, you know, sex is just for fun, it's not for commitment and marriage. Martin, what do you make of this decision this week? Were you surprised to see that? Is it something you approve of or not?
Well, I'm probably largely pro-abortion, although I recognise there are different difficulties.
Pro-abortion?
I'm not in favour of it being illegal, Tony. Okay? All right? I don't think that does any good.
Isn't it better to have the child and have it adopted and that sort of thing?
No, I don't. I think, in actual fact, those who want to say that, and of course the Catholic Church says that, we've got a situation where we've said to people that, and I believe that Reform are on side with this, that we shouldn't have a two-child benefit cap limit. I totally disagree with that, and Reform come out in that on that line. I'm with them on that one, but you can't say.
I mean, everyone in this room, and we do happen to all be men, but we were all those little fetuses once upon a time, weren't we?
All right. Well, I'm afraid this is something that was sorted out.
I'm quite glad that nobody squashed Martin out, you know, when he was a little. Anyways, I mean, so we're
all right. Well, you
asked
me what I think. I've told you.
Okay.
I'm in favour of regulated abortion. I'm in favour of regulated boozing
up until death.
Up until the moment of birth? No, the argument for the late abortions is that some of those are actually the most extreme cases where, for example, people have been raped by a relative. Yeah? So, in other words, I don't think having hard and fast rules about this, any of these things, is sensible. Medical decisions are often 50-50 decisions. For anything. So we were talking about assisted dying earlier, and we've had doctors come in on this show, and they're saying, well, in actual fact, in reality, when we're making decisions in an extreme, you know, extreme situations, it's very difficult to say what exactly is the right thing to do.
Well, abortion
and,
up until
we need
birth
to give people some space to,
and
to
assisted
make those
dying have both been legalised by this government. The assisted dying by 23 votes earlier on today.
It was a free vote, Tony, so it wasn't the government.
But Richard, what about migrants? Because this, of course, is another massive one. We had a big promise, didn't we, by Sir Keir Starmer? He was going to stop the boats. We had a big promise by Rishi Sunak. Boris, all these people have said they're going to stop the boats. None of them have.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. Yesterday when I woke up, I had this dream, and I suddenly woke up, and the dream, I'll tell you, that when I see you understand why this is relevant. I woke up, and I was actually on a beach watching, in England, suddenly a load of land appear and houses being built on it. And then suddenly I turn around, and in this dream, I was surrounded by, literally where I live, to loads of people in the house. So effectively, I was giving accommodation to these migrants. Now, obviously, I'm not paranoid. I'm very sympathetic to all races in the world. I'm not racist, as reformed people are very sympathetic to other races and not racist. And basically, I was wondering, what does this tell me? And of course, I suddenly thought, well, so you've got a situation, for example, in Iran, where Israel's talking about regime change. We've got various struggles in the world. I sometimes wonder, there could be a much, much bigger influx of immigrants than anything we've actually seen so far. And hence the dream could have been, like, are they going to end up building islands opposite where we are of people to be accommodated, etc., suddenly being asked to share with Ruth. Now, obviously, that's an extreme situation, and I hope to God that doesn't happen to the world. But the situation that people are really worried, they're already incredibly worried, and I think we've got to a boiling point about it, and that's why Reform is taking such a tough stance on it. People believe Reform, as it's not been in power during this massive build-up of immigration and illegal in this country.
But it's also, much of it is legal, isn't it?
Well, in fact,
most of it, by far, it's something like 95% of migration is legal migration with visas, work visas.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of that, I think when you speak to people, the thing they're particularly concerned is illegal migration, because they don't know what's happening. It could just, there's no limit on it. You even get figures that are currently in this country, there's 6 million illegal immigrants, and we just don't know how many there are. So there is very, very strong feelings. But all I can say is, when I knock on doorsteps, well, I know by just talking to people, they've just had enough, and they literally just can't take any more. And the economy isn't delivering for them. It's not a great time in the world. So they do want to see the end of this.
Martin, what do you think? Well, is it time to, we've had enough of migration?
Well, I think the problem is very serious, because the world economy and the geopolitical situation is very serious. So, for example, we participated in the right to protect the people of Libya. The RAF bombed the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group to power, whose headquarters have been in Manchester since the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher invited all
migrants,
the Muslims.
These illegal migrants are being brought over by organised criminal gangs.
Yes.
Those boats are from Germany. They're not from Libya.
No. Well, I'm just talking about illegal immigration in general. Okay, so loads of people ended up coming through Libya into Italy, right? The Italians will say, well, we don't want them. Perhaps because it was the RAF that used Akrotiri base to knock down Gaddafi, perhaps you should take some of them instead of us taking them all. Now, there is going to be a big problem if, for example, all these Palestinians that the Israelis want to get rid of, where do you think they might come? Mm. Since everybody learns English in school over the whole world, which gives us a great advantage in terms of international, you know, selling things to people, because they always speak our language. So we what I would say about this is, people need to take a deep breath and look at it rationally. The economic migrants is a different question. Let's just talk about the illegal ones.
Why hasn't your party stopped it, like they said they would? They were elected.
Because
one of their main planks, actually, he had I think it was 5 pledges he made. One of them, Keir Starmer, a year ago, was to stop the boats. Actually, what's happened is they've increased, and there's even more illegal migrants risking their lives by benefiting organised crime coming across the channel.
There's more people coming because the situation both globally, both in terms of war and in terms of the economy, is dire for all reasons we could go into. The point, what should happen, in my view, if you want my view about this, what should be happening about people getting boats to come across the channel is, we should be sending people over the channel to talk to all these people, decide who can come, because some of them are genuine asylum seekers under the existing rules, and then you don't have them getting into a boat, you put them on the ferry.
But organised crime is not going to take... Not organised crime is not going to take any notice of that. They're just going to move around you. They're going to laugh at you. They'll point at you.
The people,
and then they'll bring another boatload over.
The people concerned, Tony, don't have to speak to an organised crime person. They can speak to an immigration officer from this country. And there's no need to go to organised crime. Yeah? Now, that does mean that you've got to accept that some of them are going to come. Now, of course, what's happened previously with the Tory regime was, they're going to make it so difficult that people will stop coming. I have to tell you, that is not going to happen. The push factors in the world at large, look what's happened in Syria. We've now got an Al-Qaeda government in Syria, which we helped put in power. Our special forces were very involved in all of that, as they've been involved in Al-Qaeda all the way, which a lot of reform voters fail to understand, like most people in this country. And of course, the Syrians, millions of them who fled from the evil Assad regime, guess what? They don't want to go back to live under Al-Qaeda.
Let's hear, Richard, what do you make of these arguments that actually this is wars, it's not organised crime causing this?
Well, just to give an example of, I think the moment, the current cost of coming across the channel in one of these sort of boats at the moment is £2,000. So where are these people going to get this £2,000? How do they pay? They're all on mobile phones. And I do actually agree with Martin in the sense that talking to these people, though for different reasons, if they were persuaded that coming here isn't the solution because they're not welcome, things are not going to go right, they will know very quickly because they are looking at their mobile phones. So once things start happening here where they're stopped from coming or told they can't come, they will realise they're not welcome and they can start giving up on the idea. And that £2,000, interestingly, since the year 2002, is the largest discount on people coming over at the moment. So that's a low price, £2,000. So God knows what that price will be before. And then it begs the question, where are they getting this money to pay to come across? And Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, made the point recently that you look at people coming right the way across to Tunisia, coming across to Italy, and they've come all the way from the Middle East. They're going through several countries, several borders. This is organised crime in the sense of getting people across the borders. It involves a lot of organisation and it's going on. So it just shows, in her view, which I think makes sense, that they have to use all the various organs of state, the different bodies, to try and deal with this. So it's not just the police or the frontier people, it's looking at it as a whole organised situation. But at the end of the day, the resource of states like Italy or the UK is far larger than these people, and in the end, this should be possible to stop what's happening.
Well, it certainly should. We shall see. Maybe reform will get a chance to sort of line up, like everyone else has been lining up, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, to see if they can actually do anything about this. And related to a lot of this, although I think Martin doesn't really agree that it's related, is the housing crisis. Of course, if you've got 750,000 migrants coming in, legal and illegal, each year, apparently it's now going down a bit, maybe because Britain's economy isn't quite so attractive for people coming in with work visas. Certainly the student visas are very high levels, but we have a housing crisis, don't we? We certainly do here in Bristol. We were discussing last week the figures and a bit of a confrontation up on the Downs, although it wasn't as much of a confrontation as some people were suggesting it would be, with local residents saying the council is doing absolutely nothing about the now roughly 200 people living on the Downs, literally by the side of the road up there in caravans, because the housing in Bristol, the housing system in Bristol is broken. Poor people, homeless people are not being housed, and so they're realising, I'm not going to go sitting in a shop doorway. I'm going to pay a few hundred pounds to get myself a caravan so at least I can have a reasonably civilised life. But the fact is they're up on the Downs and the council haven't found anywhere else for them to go.
Well, we did have a meeting earlier in the week with Tony Nelson, who's the Protect the Downs chair. We've also got a reform person sitting on that committee, and I was there with Daniel Fearr, regional coordinator, who's with me now, who obviously helped who arranged that meeting as well. But just to give you the idea of what we're thinking at the moment, this situation, we need to analyse why people are actually on the Downs in the first place, because obviously you get stories there. I even heard one last night of Range Rovers and Airbnbs in these actual vans, again,
with the caravans.
And then we've also got a situation where people are dealing in various drugs, etc. So there's a lot of...
That's almost certainly happening in the houses too, not just the caravans. There'll be some Airbnbs up in the houses and probably some drugs too.
Absolutely. But the difference here is technically by law they shouldn't be there in the first place. Now, obviously, there will be some people who may need accommodation. That, again, shows the acute housing shortage and problem there is. And going back to your initial point on this, When I speak to people that on the doorsteps, again, they do not like the idea that illegal migrants go to the front of these queues for accommodation. They feel deprived of the accommodation that their children are not getting, because obviously house prices are beyond the reach of most children nowadays. So that's the problem. So I really obviously hope there is a solution to the Downs problem. But again, should they be in that particular area?
But why aren't the council? You see, this is where Reform UK is supposed to be strong nowadays. Mm. Local authorities have failed in many parts of the country. Reform UK, some people see this as really the only hope. What would you be doing if you were at Bristol City Council?
I think at the moment, obviously, if we had power in Bristol, we could actually enforce the bylaws and say, please go.
Well, all that's going to do is move people to another site, but outside someone else's door.
Absolutely. But there's a lead up to that process. The first thing to find out is, why are these people there? Who are they and what are they doing to monitor that situation? And then in which case we can break down the numbers. And that number will probably decline from the current number to a lower number. Obviously, certain people shouldn't be there.
Well, what do you mean they shouldn't be there?
Well, I mean, if you've got people who are dealing in drugs or, let's say, letting spaces at night or whatever else they're trying to do there.
Well, I mean, that's surely going to be a tiny minority. Most of these people, what you're doing is you're almost like saying, well, the housing crisis doesn't exist. In Bristol, it does. It's an absolutely horrendous place to try and get somewhere to live. And it's, outside London, the highest rent anywhere in the country.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's a massive problem. But I think this is such a big problem, it needs a solution on a national level, which, I mean, we look at the situation where the Bank of England has lost £130 billion of moving from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening. So just to explain, that's the process where during COVID they wanted to go ahead and buy bonds and various financial instruments from banks in order to pump money into the system. And now things are slightly better.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there was actually a financial crisis in 2019. We didn't hear much about that because COVID took over. It was a bit like 2008. The banks were saying, hey, guys, we're having real, real big problems here. So the Bank of England is doing that probably to try and sort that, you know, basically printing money to give to the banks to keep them going in 2019.
Yeah, well, I think the difference is, if you compare it to the States, their cost in the Federal Reserve is a third of a cost that's happened here in the UK. And the big difference, one of them, is what they have in the US is a thing called deferred assets. Now, deferred assets means that you can delay when you effectively are actually selling these bonds back into the market over a much longer period. It's not a fire sale. And as you know, if you do a fire sale, you're far more likely to get a worse price. And that's what the Bank of England has been doing, unfortunately. I'm not blaming them, but it's just they've gone in a bit harder.
Well, I've got no problem with you blaming the Bank of England for anything, actually, because I think they've done absolutely disastrous. I'm very glad we've still got our own currency.
Yeah, that's true.
But the Bank of England seems to be making a real mess of it. We had the Professor Steve Hall, a recording with him last week, and we had a clip of him last week as well, talking about the economy generally and criticising Rachel Reeves's spending plans last week. But I'd like to play a clip now from him where he talks about this Farage policy, Tice policy from Reform UK, where they're saying actually someone needs to go and bang heads together at the Bank of England and say, why are we paying £35 billion in interest a year to commercial banks? So let's just have a little listen to that now.
Well, Panmure, this is in the Daily Telegraph, Panmure Liberum, I'm not quite sure, I think they're some private investment company, they recently warned of an immediate and violent sterling crisis if Nigel Farage came to power.
There you go. The threats have started already. That's what they do. And sometimes they don't even have to do it. They just have to threaten. Because of the inflation after Truss. Truss did this, you know, for completely different reasons. She thought she could lower taxes, use the state's money to tide people over during difficult times and woo private equity. Stupid idea. But it wasn't that that angered the markets, i.e. the market traders and the central bankers who are working on the side of the market traders rather than the government, even though they're supposed to be governed by the Treasury, by the Treasury, which is part of the elected government.
Well, okay, look, Richard Tice, the party's deputy leader, sent a letter last week to Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England, accusing Threadneedle Street of prioritising corporate profits over the interests of working people. He claimed the bank was engaging in a systemic misuse of taxpayers' money by paying interest and selling its existing stockpile of government bonds at substantial losses. Threadneedle Street did not start paying interest on reserves until 2006, he said.
Well, that's not quite true. All reserves are interest. It's just that the interest was very low. But he's right in saying whether he means it or not, you know, whether he means it. This could be just pantomime politics. This could be a stage act because they all know each other. As Farage is a former commodity broker and Tice, of course, is a property developer. I don't know whether they're serious about this, but it's a superb and clever political move to start this antagonism with the central bank and with the money markets, because people will think at last someone out there is on our side.
Okay, Steve. Well, look, what's the best way people can find and follow you? And if you could just tell us a little bit about your books.
Well, our book, our last book, it was The Death of the Left in 2023. Well, more recent one, but it's a specialist criminological book out in this month. It was actually May the 30th. That's right. It came out May the 30th. And follow me on X, Steve Hall on X. And where I'm pontificating about economics, economic history, psychology, politics, and all the rest of it. And see if you agree with my tweets. I tweet about this sort of thing quite regularly and get quite a bit of attention. I think I'm right about this. I think that really we need to face up, face up to the reality that we're subservient, we're subjugated by global money markets, and we can't carry on like this. And we must take our economy under the management of our elected representatives, who can work in some ways with private capital. I mean, Attlee didn't abolish capitalism, and neither did Deng Xiaoping. In fact, he brought it back in order to help China develop. But the difference between China and this country, and America, of course, and Europe, is that in China, the politicians control the bankers and the central bankers and the big corporate players. Over here, the corporate players, the bankers and the central bankers control the politicians. The relationship is the inverse. And Tyson Farage have made noises about reclaiming that power on behalf of the people. They might mean it and they might not, but either way, it's a very clever political move, and once again, they've outflanked the stupid left.
And finally, do you think maybe that they're forcing the Labour government's hand on some of these issues, like the, for example, the winter fuel payments? It seems that they've kind of out-lefted the left.
Well, it's that's a U-turn that everyone expected, because, I mean, that just makes the Labour Party appear to be vicious Calvinists. You have the likes of Rachel Reeves and Liz Kendall. They don't have very attractive ideas, morally attractive ideas. They seem to have reverted to some sort of, Victorian, almost soft eugenics. And it's quite nasty, and it's turning voters away. You've seen what's happened. The Labour Party, their popularity has plummeted. So again, clever move by Reform. But the fact remains that, we need braver politicians. We need international agreement. We would suffer if only Britain stood up to their money markets. We need agreement from the Americans. And don't forget, what did Roosevelt do? One of the first things he did in 1933 was separate investment banking from the clearing banks and clip the wings of the investment bankers. It's one of the first things he did. And following that, he began to drag the US out of the depression. Corporate capitalists quite like recessions and depressions, because they reboot the system, they gain assets in the fire sale, and they can start again in a few years' time making big profits out of the wreckage. They don't mind recessions at all, but recessions are awful for ordinary people. And the sort of kowtowing that the Labour Party has done to this sort of economic thinking has ruined its reputation amongst most of the population, and it will be very, very difficult to recover.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much for joining us again.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, so that's Professor Steve Hall speaking to me last week, but about Reform UK, Richard, and it seems actually there's quite a lot of alignment there. Is there anything you'd like to point out about what Steve was saying?
Yeah, I'm obviously very pleased to hear that, and it's obviously a subject that needs to be talked about, because there's really big money here that could deal with a lot more, big things on a massive scale. The first point I'd like to make is just on this whole thing about the sort of interest that the Bank of England pays on the reserves that the banks hold at the Bank of England. Even Sir Charlie Bean, who's till recently been the Deputy Governor, well respected, he actually is not saying that he thinks there should be interest, no interest on the reserves at all. But he's saying that, that the idea of reducing that interest level is a good idea. So I'm not saying that's the solution. It's not going as far as reform, but that's already showing that people within the establishment are taking this thing seriously.
So would those and commercial banks lend the money to the Bank of England if they weren't getting any interest?
I think the bottom line is they may have to, because sometimes there's actually nowhere else for them to go. And one of the good things about reform doing this, it's bringing this whole Bank of England stuff to debate. And obviously for some time I've been saying it myself that another problem that exists at the moment is I think interest rates are too high for the actual situation in the economy. I mean, for example, the Institute of Economic Affairs believes that the inflation target, rather than set an arbitrary 2%, should be set at a level that is at the equivalent of the GDP spending figure, which basically includes growth plus inflation. So therefore, the interest rate will be lower because it will deem that, because at the moment, inflation is deemed to be 3.4 instead of the 2% target. So interest rates are hiked up all the way to, I mean, current yield on the bonds, 10-year is gilts are 4.55%. So if you're thinking that any business, small business, anyone buying a house, that's 4.55% plus whatever, you know, extra the banks charge. So to my mind, if the Bank of England target was changed, which the Parliament here has got the power to do, now I'm not saying these things, that would just make a massive difference throughout the whole economy, it would create more jobs. The stock market might improve, the whole situation of lending, people might be able to get mortgages more easily. So that could really help, and it's a big, big measure.
Well, look, Steve made that point about Liz Truss, didn't he? What do you make of that?
I mean, obviously, Liz Truss, comparing to Nigel Farage, has no business experience or no experience in the financial markets, nor did Kwasi Kwarteng at all. And the way they did it, no disrespect to them, is you don't go suddenly changing the whole policy overnight without consulting people in the city and doing it gently. She just did it almost straight away with no consultation. Anyone who knows the financial markets knows that is explosion. It's not going to work. But I think before, Nigel Farage has been the financial markets a lot. Richard Tice has been in different ways.
Hang on, the Bank of England themselves last week were saying that if Farage tries to do this, it's going to cause instability. So he's implying a similar kind of reaction to Truss.
Well, I'm sure Andrew Bailey, the current Bank of England governor, does not want this. But if he talks to Sir Charlie Bean, who is the deputy governor, he would have there's some value in actually going ahead and at least not paying interest on part of the reserve. So at least that debate needs to be had. And I'm not necessarily saying that a reform government should do this on the first day they're in office. There needs to be a lot of soundings taken the city and an education of it. And actually there are people in the States who have the same view as well. I mean, it's not just in, you know, when you look at Bloomberg TV or CNBC, it does come up from time to time, the idea this 2% target, which they've also got in the States, is arbitrary. It's set about two decades ago. It doesn't have to be 2%.
The key thing here is that we're constantly hearing, oh, there's not enough money for this, there's not enough money for that. Actually, maybe there is, and this is a bit of a emperor's new clothes.
I do feel there is an element to that, definitely, because at the moment we're in a situation where we're banging on our heads ourselves with too harsh an interest rate regime too soon after certain financial crises. The problem is the BOE, the Bank of England, the Fed Reserve, they're looking at things on a day-to-day basis. What's the market doing now? 1 month, 2 months. But, you know, things take time to adjust in the real market. People with real decisions, real mortgages, real people, small businesses, they don't make the decision on one day. They make the decision after a few weeks or months or even 6 months a year later.
Hang on, because Steve is making a different point, really, yeah, which is that the Bank of England and the Treasury are really working for corporate profiteers. They're not working for the voters.
I think that's an interesting area, because I'm also...
Well, they're not pushing back enough.
Yeah, I think they're not pushing back enough. And then the Bank of England's got its independence. It's going to fight tooth and nail for that right. It's going to be very, very careful not to lose that. And another problem that makes this more complicated is any losses on quantitative easing or quantitative tightening, whatever, the Treasury indemnifies the Bank of England, which means whatever's done to sort out any losses or whatever, it's all, or any getting the money back, is going to be done too quickly, where in the States it's different. That money is not by way of indemnity, it's by way of deferred asset, which means basically got much longer to get this all sorted out.
Completely separate to this. In fact, we did this a bit earlier on with the attack on Iran by the Israelis and comparing that to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. What I'm going to do now, I'm going to play a clip now from Adam Curtis's new film, Shifty, which looks back to the 1980s. And this is just out. It's a I mean, I love Adam Curtis, although it's a, in a similar way to I like John Peel, because you listen to a John Peel program, you'd hear two or three absolutely impossible to listen to songs, and then suddenly an absolute blinder would come around the corner. And it's exactly the same with Adam Curtis. He puts all sorts of silly, ridiculous things, like about a dog that's changing his sex, a great long interview with the lady owner of the dog, and then suddenly an absolute bombshell from the 1980s with Alan Budd, who was the chief economic advisor to Margaret Thatcher, saying, well, actually, Thatcher didn't really understand anything, it was all a big illusion, and they were pulling the wool over her eyes all the way through. So anyway, let's have a listen to a little compilation now of a few interviews, including one with Alan Budd. I'm not quite sure who else is in here. Anyway, yeah, what I'll do is I'll say probably afterwards who it is. But this is a little extract from this new film by Adam Curtis. Well worth a download, well worth a watch and listen to. Or you can watch it on the iPlayer. Shifty by Adam Curtis on the BBC.
The other are the hard left, operating inside our system, conspiring to use union power and the apparatus of local government to break, defy, and subvert the law. That is when we have to stand up and be counted. That is when we have to do what we believe to be right.
The nightmare I sometimes have about this whole experience runs as follows. I was involved in making a number of proposals which were partly at least adopted by the government and put in play by the government. Now, my worry is as follows, that there may have been people making the actual policy decisions, or people behind them, who never believed for a moment that this was the correct way to bring down inflation. They did, however, see that it would be a very, very good way to raise unemployment. And raising unemployment was an extremely desirable way of reducing the strength of the working classes, if you like. That what was engineered there, in Marxist terms, was a crisis of capitalism which recreated the reserve army of labour and has allowed the capitalists to make high profits ever since. Now, again, I don't say I believe that story, but when I really worry about all this, I worry whether, indeed, that was really what was going on.
Monday turned out to be a watershed. We came in not really knowing what to expect after the hurricane and everything else, and we simply stared at the screens all day, watching the sea of red, as it was known, watching financial prices falling, and realizing that the British people had simply lost control over their economy. We had all been led to believe that Mrs. Thatcher was in control of events. A lot of us suspected that perhaps that was an exaggeration. It was clear that she was trying to cover up a lot of the cracks with a lot of rhetoric. We had to accept the logic of the market, which was quite simply that there was no longer any entity which we could reasonably and realistically call the great British economy.
Do you think she knew that?
I suspect that towards the end, with the kind of problems which emerged at the end, she began to suspect that perhaps she had been chasing an illusion, yes.
No, it's not heavy. This is all in porcelain. The quality of the work is superb. But look above all at the expression on the faces of the Marines. No gloating at all, but just unbelievable kindliness and pride once again in raising the flag of Britain. More than that, restoring freedom to the people of the Falklands. It is the spirit of Britain, and it is everything that makes us great.
So that's a little extract from Shifty by Adam Curtis. And so you heard there Alan Budd, who was chief economic advisor to Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, or certain part of the 1980s. He was saying, Martin, wasn't he, something very interesting. He was saying, well, there was all this talk about we've got to do this and this and this to bring down inflation. Actually, what he's saying is that the real policy was just increasing unemployment, because that benefited the city.
Well, I was aware of him saying that years ago. I think he was a monetarist economist, and he was quite a technical type person, and he really thought, when he was advising the then Conservative government, that it really was about getting inflation down. But of course he then came to the conclusion that maybe this wasn't about that, this is about a shift in the balance of power in the society against the trade unions and so on, which of course I agree with. So
I mean, that was when he comes always, out with that, I'm going, yes, okay, always, I agree with always you, going to be necessary when you when you're deindustrializing. The unions are going to be the first in the firing line, aren't they, whether they're the coal miners or whether they're the print unions, for example, at Wapping.
Well, that's true, but also, of course, it's quite weak hand that you're playing, because if they're trying to get rid of you anyway, going on strike is a defensive manoeuvre. You can't really expect to win. And, of course, that's exactly what happened with the miners' strike. There was a possibility to settle it on some terms which would have kept the industry functional, but neither side was prepared to accept those terms, and so we ended up where we ended up.
So what I'll do is I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to Adam Curtis's Shifty on the iPlayer, and I think it's up on YouTube as well. Anyway, Richard, what do you make of hearing that? Because a lot of what we're hearing the last couple of weeks from Reform UK is we need a bit of reindustrialisation. We need to potentially reopen the Port Talbot steelworks with a proper blast furnace, not some kind of electronic green thing, and also even maybe open some coal mines. So I just wonder what you make of that, what we were hearing there about the 1980s and the deindustrialisation under Thatcher.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the world has changed in many ways, obviously since what we're, let's say, looking with some comments just being made in terms of inflation as well. Since the 1980s, obviously the world trade flows of money in terms of trade and indeed speculative monies have actually increased a lot, and indeed interdependence with different areas. So let's say the COVID happened, or let's say the Ukraine conflict have definite effects here on inflation in terms of oil price, etc. Things that we're more interconnected. So obviously it's not necessarily just unemployment, base increase unemployment deal with inflation. Inflation's got many components. But going to your particular question about the Wales situation, obviously Nigel Farage is, as you rightly say, he's not into the Tata Steel situation where they want to have a green electric furnace which will be completed in 2028. There's been £500 million put in by the government there, and the rest is coming from Tata. He's not really going for that. He's nor is he going for using existing blast furnaces. He's going for a new one, basically. That does, he admit, costs several billion. I think it's £3 billion it would cost there. But the idea of that is that it gives security to this country in terms of, obviously, we're in a situation where the world is to some extent deglobalizing. We've got situations where recently Russia was previously a very big supplier of steel. One of their big companies has just stopped doing that. We've obviously got China that is flooding the market to some extent with steel as well. But if you look, it's not just that one's protecting national security. There's also an economic argument as well. If you look at the prices of steel and coal, they're very, very up and down as well. And you could have a situation where during the commodity boom in the mid-2000s, you had people like Mittal, etc., making an absolute fortune from steel anywhere in the world. Now, that's not the current situation. But the idea is if you have a surplus of supply within your own economy, you can deal with the ups and downs of the market economy. One of the frailties of the market economy is it does often leave not enough supply in the system when things go wrong. So that's the supply protection as well. So in terms of that policy, he's obviously not going to, if let's say Reform do take control of the Senate in Cardiff, they cannot do this, or it's going to be hard to do it without the national government in London. But obviously, if there's a Reform government, which we hope in London as well, and also one in Cardiff, then that's something they can really look at.
Okay, well, do you want to say in layman's terms where you're going to find the money to do this? And I don't want to hear we're going to be taking it from disabled people like the Labour Party are.
Right, I thought you were going to say not from the Bank of England, so fiasco. But I think I'd answer that firstly. Obviously, we're dealing with billions of pounds in the figures I've just given in the Bank of England situation. Beyond that, Nigel Farage's argument that these people, if they're made unemployed, might be on benefits, they're going to be a cost to the economy. So if that can be in some way circulated back, it's going to work better. And as you know, with all these businesses, even with Tata, the Welsh government is making payments to the smaller businesses that have been affected. So there's a whole load of supply chains down the economy that are going to be affected when it's going away. But conversely, when you bring back the steel production, you're going to be bringing these back in, which will create jobs and some economic vibrancy in those areas.
Martin, does that make any sense to you?
Yes, I think what's interesting about what's happening now is because the Conservative Party, because of their association with what happened in the 1980s, they're not in a position to make this argument. You are, because you're a new force. So I welcome that, but obviously from my point of view, it doesn't go far enough. Yeah, it's opening the debate up, which I welcome. And of course, what Steve Tucker would be saying is, well, we don't have to do it. We don't
have to. Steve Hall?
Steve Hall, sorry. We don't have to actually. There's no relationship between selling bonds and spending money. Yeah? You don't have to actually get the money from the private sector banking system. In China, the banks ultimately are owned by the government, which means that they don't have to worry about stuff like that. And that looks to me like the wave of the future.
Steve is always pushing this thing, modern monetary theory.
Well, modern monetary theory is very,
which is saying very simply, I'm going to try and make it simple, which is your central bank makes up the money free of charge. You don't borrow it from a commercial bank. This is a massive mistake to do this. Am I right in saying that's basically it?
I mean, the Bank of England was nationalised in 1946. The Federal Reserve in the United States set up in 1913 is still basically a private cartel. It's got some legal barriers around it, but the central bank, not the central bankers, the commercial bankers in New York sit on the board of the New York Fed, and they determine the policy fundamentally. The Bank of England is not determined by the city because it is nationalised, but on the other hand, they definitely listen to the city and follow what they say because that's part of their job to do that. But I think ultimately we're probably going to go into a fairly major economic crisis before the next election, and not just in this country. And we're going to have to consider all sorts of options. So it's good that we're starting to talk about them, isn't it?
Richard, what about priorities? Nigel Farage has talked about steel and coal. What other priorities to bring into some kind of public control or public ownership?
Well, reform policy at the last election, the contract was that basically you'd have utilities should be 50% owned by the government, 50% by a collection of British pension funds. Now, obviously, the big case example where reforms obviously had comments recently has been, like, we've obviously got the Thames Water situation, yeah, where reform has been ahead of the Labour Party, which even now today, as you know, with these stories, as the situation gets more dire day by day as it gets nearer to a special administration of the company Thames Water, the Labour government is now increasingly talking about nationalisation, but reform was ahead of the curve on that.
Martin, are you embarrassed as a Labour Party member?
I am indeed. It's just wrong. I mean, what should have happened with Thames Water a long time ago, it should have just been put into receivership. Mm. The people who wasted money investing in it, we should actually be chasing them down because they owe us money. Mm. So what they're saying is we've got to pay £20 billion or £20 million to buy it back. And we don't have to do that. There's no reason to do that. You just put it through receipts. It's a bankruptcy procedure. That's what capitalism's about. You know, you've lost your money, bye-bye.
Why are the Labour Party not saying these very sensible things?
Because they're getting quite a lot of their funding these days from the City of London. It used to be the trade unions. Arthur Scargill sort of used to. That's no longer the case. No.
Of
course, that will obviously be a problem for a reform government because some of your funding will be coming from people like this, and they're going to have their views about what
you
do.
So I didn't. I tried to interrupt you, Richard, but you were just starting to talk about some of the things which maybe a reform central government would be able to actually intervene and maybe utilities and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So we've got utilities. Obviously, reform were pretty early when Richard Tice was wearing a badge in the Commons supporting the situation in the Scunthorpe Steelworks, which is formerly owned by a Chinese company, now British Steel under the realms of the government. Now, that has gone into a nationalisation situation, but again, reform was ahead of the Labour Party on that as well. So that shows that's a sort of look of reform government you're looking at in the future, where it will intervene in certain areas that haven't been intervened for some time.
So what about gas, electricity, railways? There's quite a long list of possibilities. Actually, the railways seem to be tumbling back into public ownership all of their own accord.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you've got lots of things in the rail industry, and obviously people still look at that should end up being nationalised. But again, reform's current policies at so far is that it should be 50% owned by the state, 50% by the private sector. But let's say we end up with a situation where it's similar to the situation, let's say, in Scunthorpe with British Steel stroke the Chinese firm that owned it, and indeed we go over to Port Talbot or in Thames Water. It shows where necessary reform will move quickly and act quickly. And one thing just to say about the reform people, that would be doing this. They are less bureaucratic than the previous governments in the way they would act. They would go ahead quickly, and they're used to doing things quickly, whereas people who've been in power for a long time tend to move a bit slower.
Okay, finally, can you just talk a bit about foreign policy? Because anyone who's trying to make waves in national government, which Reform is certainly in a position, you know, if there was an election tomorrow to do that, what's your position on the two big conflicts in the world at the moment? That's one in the Middle East with Israel and Gaza, which is the main one, although we've got another one that seems to have started up over the last week or so with Iran. And also, of course, between Ukraine and Russia. I remember noting with some amusement that Nigel Farage had said, well, actually it was NATO that provoked the Russians to invade Ukraine. So what's your position on those two?
Well, I think Reform's position is obviously every country has the right to defend itself, whether it's Ukraine or Israel. In the situation where you've got this conflict in Palestine, for example, in Gaza, it's obviously not good. It's terrible what's happening in there as well. You've got a situation where Ukraine is a dangerous situation. But one of the things they did say in the contract is sometimes you do have to work with regimes that you don't necessarily agree with their policies in order to further peace. So if I was betting on peace, I'd rather be betting on someone like Nigel Farage than someone in the situation of the Labour Party or some of these other parties that seem to find it a bit more easier to drift into conflicts.
Well, no, I want to hear a bit more from you, please, about what you think the rights and wrongs are in those two conflicts. I mean, it's very easy to say we're going to sit down and talk peace, but how? How would you? Whose fingers need to be held to the fire to get the peace that we all want?
Yeah, I think basically, some of it's about how you get on with people and how you work with people. I mean, Putin, my guess is more likely to do a deal with someone like Trump than, let's say, Biden, just in terms of the way that they can, the chemistry of the two people. With Reform, obviously, Nigel Farage isn't Prime Minister at the moment. Hopefully he will be, and a lot believe he will be soon. So that's got to be tested. On a private view, obviously, I've got three young sons. I don't want them to be conscripted into some war in Ukraine or something like that. And I think it's absolutely terrible. At the end of the day, we are up against a nuclear power, which is Russia, and we've got to bear that in mind.
But that's okay. We're a nuclear power too, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's but that's the whole thing, isn't it? Because once you're into this sort of stalemate, and it's a very, very difficult situation. But let's look at where we are in the world right now. If a peace had been agreed back in 2022 after February, relatively soon, Putin was offering the part of the enclaves in the Donetsk region and Luhansk. And obviously Crimea and some protections for Russians in the Ukraine area. Now the deal on the table is, if it does happen, is going to be far worse. So all I'm saying is this conflict with all the horrific suffering that's happened in Ukraine, Russia, and indeed in the wider world, when we're talking about the economy and all the jobs that have been affected, inflation throughout the world, the high oil price that ensued afterwards, and the COVID shock doubled by the Ukraine shock, it just shows by continuing with these conflicts in that way is not necessarily the solution.
Well, look, after the break, we're going to be hearing direct from Northern Gaza, which not many people are able to do, but we will. So what do you make of that conflict? We've seen over the last week or so this horrific shooting of people who are coming to try and get aid. Killing of something like 70 people a night have been being killed as they try and get aid, shot dead by the Israeli army.
That's horrifically sad that's happened, and obviously these sort of situations happen. Obviously, I don't know that much about this particular situation to make a judgment as to why or how or who's responsible and who's at fault.
Well, there are Israeli guns and Israeli soldiers, and there are Palestinians who are dying and hungry and starving.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen that, but let's assume that I haven't seen that particular case, but let's assume that is a case. That's horrific and shouldn't happen. I mean, then they're unarmed civilians dealing with an invading force, and obviously Israel needs to be careful in that situation in terms of the way it's seen by the world, not to be too hard on people in that situation.
Okay, Richard, if people are interested in Reform UK here in Bristol or other parts of the country, can you just give us an idea of, I don't want to hear you can go to this website. Do you actually meet in person? Or can people actually go and see Reform?
Yeah.
Should we say ring flesh and actually talk and have a pint with Reform people?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a meet-up every month, sometimes twice a month and sometimes even more. And we have them in different pubs in throughout Bristol.
Oh, that's just here in Bristol. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Right. So we do that, and we welcome people there, and there's no money to be paid, and people get on really well, and there's a bit of a community emerging of people getting to know each other. The good thing is people can have a good discussion about politics. They're not formal, and people love, you know, having a good natter, and they get on really well with each other. So very, very encouraging.
Okay, and in other parts of the country, similar?
Yeah, similar, absolutely. They're growing there as well, and it's throughout the whole country, really, so that's going very well.
What sort of say? I'm not saying that Labour Party members, like Martin here, get much of a say in Labour policy. Do the members get any say in what Reform does?
With Reform? We get no. Obviously, we get no say in what Reform does.
No. But you don't get any say in what Labour do. But anyway, what about Reform, Richard, finally?
In Reform, I mean, we do get say in the sense that obviously if things are, let's say, passed on to me, like I'll try and pass them on higher up. There's, at the moment, we've got a branch structure that's emerging throughout the country. We've got quite a lot of branches emerging. And the way things will work is branch will feed into who the candidates are, let's say, for council elections and general elections, which in a sense will be feeding into the general mandate of the government in Westminster and indeed in local councils.
And what about so many people that just say, oh, Farage is just a racist?
I've met Farage a few times, and I honestly don't think he's racist at all. I mean, literally, there's so many people, both within Reform and outside, who are either got... I mean, I've got foreign blood myself. I've got, you know, I've travelled all over the world. I've got Muslim friends, and I put myself in a category with most Reform people. They're not looking at being racist at all. It's really, the problem is they're just saying we've just had enough of what's happened in an economy where it's just not delivering, and they just think there's just too many illegal migrants.
Okay, Richard Vichik from Bristol Reform UK, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all, evermore. Amen.
We now stand and sing the hymn, Hail the Day That Sees Him Rise. Alleluia. Thank you. God the Father, who has given to his Son the name above every name, strengthen you to proclaim Christ Jesus as Lord. God the Son, who is our great High Priest, passed into the heavens, plead for you at the right hand of the Father. God the Holy Spirit, who pours out his abundant gifts upon the Church, make you faithful servants of Christ our King. And the blessing of God Almighty abendeth you hota theog, a tad, a mab, ar ysbryd glân, a fo'n eich plith, ac adrigo gyda chwi yn wastad.
Amen.
I'm crying. lines drawn between the good of us and the bad of us. See the blind man cheating at the word, the bullets flying, they're killing everyone. If you've been bad, Lord, I bet you and you've not been hit. You've not been hit by flying yet. You'd better close your eyes. You'd better bow your head. Wait for the
Sheffield Lads out in Japan, Deep Purple playing Child in Time, one of my favourite little, well, not little, quite big and long anti-war songs. Double LP, Deep Purple, made in Japan, lent to me 1978, it must have been, roughly, by a certain Nick Land, father of accelerationism. One of the things Nick pointed out was that halfway through that, you can hear him say to the Japanese, who don't understand a word of English, pretty much most of them, you're only about 4 foot six, but don't worry about it. There's always someone smaller than you. That's Ian Gillan in the middle of the concert. A bit cheeky. Before that, we had St. David's Cathedral, a little bit from them. But that is it for the music, a little music break. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. With Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I think maybe, Martin, we should start with what, for me, is the big news of the week. Back in 2012, Ofcom, who go to the Bilderberg conferences, they're supposed to be an independent broadcasting regulator, but of course they're not. They're occupied. They banned Press TV And on Monday this week, the Israelis and the Americans and the British bombed the state broadcaster, destroyed transmitters, studios in Iran.
Well, yes, it's shades of what happened in Belgrade in the 1990s when they bombed the Serbian national TV station and killed a load of journalists. And, of course, the Americans knocked out Al Jazeera in Afghanistan and in Iraq, didn't they?
So isn't it interesting to hear Israeli ministers saying that anyone that watches Al Jazeera is a terrorist? These people have completely lost it, haven't they?
Well, they have, and of course, one of the things the Iranians have done is they've warned people in Israeli Channel 14 that they need to leave the building because they're going to end up being casualties as well, unless they leave the building.
So what do you make of this whole business of blowing up your opposition's television? Because obviously Ofcom is working alongside Netanyahu.
Well, I think what the Iranians are doing at this stage of the game is they're waiting to see what the other side does, and then they're giving it back to them in spades. So the escalation ladder remains where it is. Yeah, if you bomb our TV station, we will bomb yours. You see, the big news yesterday and today was that a hospital has been damaged in Israel. I don't think there's any deaths, but there are some injuries. And what the Iranians have said, we were attacking a cyber warfare center right next to the hospital. And of course, we hit the cyber warfare center, but I'm afraid there was a bit of blowback on the hospital. That is quite different from eliminating all the hospitals in Gaza quite deliberately. That's not the same thing at all, is it?
No, certainly isn't. And just to talk about the attack on the broadcaster, I think Afshan Ratanzi, he's a very interesting character. He's been all over the place. I think he was on RT from time to time on Press TV. But certainly, I think one of the best with his Going Underground hat tip to the Jam with his journalism around the world. He was one of the first people to speak out on Monday evening about this Israeli attack on INRB, I think it's called, the Iranian state broadcaster, blowing up their studios, transmitters, etc. But somehow they managed to carry on. But anyway, let's have a listen to Afshin now.
Amongst all the media companies I worked for, The Guardian, CNN, the BBC's Today programme, I actually did do some work for Press TV. That's the international service of the Iranian TV channel. Its parent company, IRIB, has just been bombed by British, European Union and United States armed munitions of Israel. This is NATO playbook stuff. Britain, NATO, they illegally bombed the Belgrade television in Yugoslavia as part of their wars of freedom and liberation. They always want to stop a free media. That's why there's so much censorship, not just in Israel, about the current hostilities between Israel and Iran, or maybe Donald Trump and Iran. It's what NATO does. They need a totalitarian system to prevent their populations from understanding the world. Otherwise, their elites would face trouble and face their end, perhaps. Those in power in NATO countries, it would be the end of them if the publics that vote for them, of course, it's not a real vote, because without information, there can be no democracy. Noam Chomsky, Gore Vidal, these are the kinds of figures that I used to interview in Tehran when I lived there, and it'd be broadcast on IRIB channels. Of course, no one in Washington, London, or Brussels, Paris, Berlin wants the like of Gore Vidal, the late Gore Vidal now, and Noam Chomsky now. The late, not quite the late, he's in a coma, Noam Chomsky. They don't want that information out there. So, on top of bombing and destroying the Kermanshah Hospital in Iran this morning, they are now taking out the media, because that is the playbook of NATO powers. If Britain, the United States, and the European Union believe that anyone, the global majority, the global South, and the working classes of the country themselves, believe in their leaders or their elites, or rather believe either that they are condemned to some kind of dystopia, or the few of them who believe the time now is for change in those countries, they have another thing coming. Not a good time, but I suppose updates will be coming fast and in detail in the next few hours as Iran prepares a response that they say is 20 times the number of missiles so far they've used against this proxy in the Middle East with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, he's saying actually he's not really saying that Israel is attacking Iran's broadcasters, is he? He's saying the European Union, America and Britain are attacking them.
Well, he may well be right. I think that a lot of what goes on is distraction. So we were told to think that there is some kind of split between Israel and the West. And I mean, look what Trump just did, where he strung along the Iranians to come to all of these meetings, and so they just thought, well, perhaps we can do a deal.
This is a bit like the Minsk agreements,
because the Minsk agreements were the Americans weren't involved in the Minsk agreements. The Minsk agreements were between the parties inside the Ukraine, and there were three powers which basically were the guarantors of the agreement. That was Russia, Germany, and France. And both Britain and the US were deliberately excluded from those meetings because they were felt to be too involved. And the Russians took the Germans and the French at their word. Let's just fix this up. Let's find a compromise. But then later on, it transpires that Merkel and I think it wasn't Hollande, was it? I can't remember who it was now. The French president of the time, they openly said, we were stringing the Russians along because all we really wanted to do was rearm the Ukrainians to try and recapture
the territory. So the idea is don't bother to negotiate with these people because they're conning you, they're tricking you. As we heard last week with the US negotiations, they're using the negotiations to identify who are the scientific experts so the next week they can kill them.
Well, that's what they did with Haniyeh, who was the main negotiator for Hamas to try and get the hostages freed. So what do?
When they say to Haniyeh, can I have your mobile number, please? That means because a few days' time, they're going to be sending a Hellfire missile to blow up his mobile and him.
That's right. And, of course, this is what we're dealing with. Now, of course, what that leads to is a situation where fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Doesn't it? So there's no way that we can have any deals now. We're into the World War III thing, and there's going to be no deals that are going to make it easier. It's just fight.
The idea is, not deal ready. Understanding is something that they don't seem to be very interested in us understanding. We were talking earlier about this idea of fitting the intelligence around the policy. The idea is surely in a normal, rational world, you have a look at what's going on and then you decide what to do. In this world we're in now, with NATO in charge, Israel in charge, Britain and America in charge, they've decided what to do secretly. And so there's no rationale that they can make out to you. And so it's the other way around. There's no need for you to understand. You're not supposed to even try and understand. Very Orwellian.
It is very Orwellian, or a Brave New World-ish, or whatever you want to call it.
In George Orwell's novel, in 1984, there are all sorts of weird things that happen. I can't remember exactly. Maybe you remember better than me. Where suddenly everybody is the former enemies from the previous week are no longer the enemies. They're now our friends, and you're not even supposed to notice.
Well, indeed, and of course the book's been very influential, but what we're actually living through is in some respects, it's different and worse.
And it's not supposed to make sense. It's not supposed to make sense because the narrative that we're getting from the mainstream press, particularly the London press, obviously, in this country, is just nonsense. It's lies. It's spin. Very much like, Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. We're being told all these policies are necessary to get inflation down. They weren't. There's nothing to do with inflation. It was all about making mass unemployment to benefit people in the city. Seems to me these things just go on and on. But anyway, what do you think is going to be... How long do you think this conflict between Israel and Iran is going to go on? At the moment, they're sort of tit-for-tat every evening with another TV station or hospital or whatever being blown up every evening, or intelligence organization in Tel Aviv.
Well, it's hard to predict how long it's going to go on. It's going to go on until it ends, which will be several years, I'd say, unless we're very unlucky, in which case it's all going to end before the end of the year, and we won't be talking about this in 2026 because we won't be here.
Well, one of the people who's been talking about this is someone you sort of introduced me to last week, Martin. His name's Ibrahim Traore, and he represents a sort of new anti-colonial, post-colonial group of leaders. He's president of Burkina Faso right now, but he seems to be globetrotting all around the place, saying, well, actually, we've had enough of the New World Order. We've had enough of the post-colonial era where they're using finance and debt to enslave everybody. We're breaking free.
Why is Edward Snowden a fugitive for revealing you spy on everyone and you lecture us about human rights? How many civilians died in your drone strikes? You say collateral damage and move on. How many weddings did you strike in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia? How many schools did you bomb? How many hospitals did you burn? And you teach us the laws of war? Look, I come from war. I know the front. I've seen death. I've carried wounded soldiers. I've consoled mothers of martyrs. And I tell you, a real soldier protects his people. A real soldier doesn't harm civilians. A real soldier fights with honor. Your mercenaries, your drone pilots, your special forces, they're not soldiers. They're killers. They kill people by pressing buttons from 10,000 kilometers away, then go home and play with their children. We don't fight like that. We look our enemy in the face. We protect civilians. We fight with our honor. We die with our honor. And we'll win, because the righteous win, because those who fight with their people win, because those who fight for their land win. Let's return to your media. I know how you work. I have friends who work within the system. There are journalists with conscience, but they stay silent. Why? Because the system silences them. Those who write the truth get fired. Investigative journalists are laid off due to budget cuts. Dissenting columnists are shown the door because reader interest has declined. And what replaces them? Experts from think tanks, NGOs, universities, all saying the same thing, all defending the same thesis. West is good, Africa is bad. So who are these experts? Where do they get their funding? National Endowment for Democracy, NED, American Democracy Exporter, CIA's legal arm, has fingers everywhere, funds opposition, directs media, creates civil society. Open Society Foundations, George Soros's organization, says open society, but open for whom? Open to what? Open to exploitation, open to intervention, open to manipulation. Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, all in Africa, doing aid. But what do they get in return? Control, data, influence. And your media is their trumpet. You headline, Gates is saving Africa. But you don't say, how many African children were paralyzed by Gates's vaccine trials? How many farmers committed suicide because of Monsanto seeds? You're masters at storytelling, but always the same story. White savior. Remember Live Aid? 1985. We Are the World. Charity concert for Africa. Millions raised. What came to Africa? Corruption increased. Dependency increased. But it was a great story for you. Bob Geldof became a hero. Musicians looked conscientious. Viewers felt good about themselves. Africa remained hungry. Remember Kony 2012? Viral video. Stop Joseph Kony. 100 million views. Result? Kony is still free, but the video maker got rich. Invisible Children Organization collected millions. What came to Uganda? American soldiers. And you present these as success stories. Angelina Jolie, Madonna, Bono, all Africa volunteers. They come, take photos, adopt children, leave. And you say, interest in Africa increased. What interest? Whose interest? Interest for what? Madonna adopted from Malawi. You made headlines. But 100 children die from malaria every day in Malawi. You didn't write that, because that news doesn't sell. Bono became Africa's spokesperson, raised billions with U2 concerts, but moved his company to Netherlands to avoid taxes. Money stolen from Africa also passes through Netherlands. Did you write about this? George Clooney campaigned for Darfur, said save Darfur. Result? Sudan split. Oil remained in South Sudan. South Sudan is now in civil war. Who's getting the oil? Take a guess. And you always present these as humanitarian aid. But these are imperialism's soft face. These are exploitation's PR. Let me give you real numbers. Every year, $134 billion in aid and investment comes to Africa. Every year, $192 billion in resources leave Africa. Net loss, $58 billion every year.
And he goes on and on and on. He's almost unstoppable, this guy.
Well, that's what the powers that be in the West think, so they don't like him at all. But on the other hand, he's obviously a big star of the emerging multipolar order.
Well, you know what? He's a bit of a star over here too, I think.
Well, I mean, I thoroughly agree with what he's saying, but many people in this country will have no idea who he is, Tony. No, come on.
Doesn't matter who he is, but hang on. What he's saying here makes quite a lot of sense.
Well, that's true, and that's why they're not going to be told it, and that's why they're never going to know.
Well, they're saying how much money comes into Africa and how much money comes out of Africa in terms of resources. He's making a very important point, which has been being made by campaigners and pressure groups in this country, like Oxfam, etc., War on Want, for decades, but nothing's really changed.
No, and of course, if we were to actually have a net transfer of resources to the developing world and allow them to invest those resources in their people, then maybe we wouldn't have all these people coming across the road, the channel in dinghies, because they could actually get a job at home.
As another anti-London, anti-West media studio gets bombed to smithereens, smashed to pieces, God knows how many producers, journalists or whatever, they don't seem to care how many of those they kill either, from the Israeli, the British, the Brussels and the American side. Let's take a bit of a flashback to the 1930s, because I came across this recently, which was quite a good little talk by Orson Welles about his 1936, I think it was, War of the Worlds, and why they did that, because it certainly wasn't an innocent mistake.
We did on the show exactly what would have happened if the world had been invaded. That little music playing and then an announcer coming on and saying, "Excuse me, we interrupt this program to bring you an announcement from Jersey City. Jersey City has just fallen." Take you back to our studio, a little organ music, and then another interruption, and so on. We did all of that very carefully and exactly reproduced, as I say, what would have happened, thinking to make the whole thing more effective. But we had no idea how effective it would be, because about halfway through the show, as we were continuing with the script in front of us, we saw that in the control room there were a great many policemen, and every moment more. Now, later we found out that the police were as confused as we were, because there wasn't anything they could arrest us for, but there they were, looking fierce, and a lot of people talking to other people in dumb show, and a very tense atmosphere was generated in the studio. We thought, well, something's gone wrong. Some few people have complained and have swallowed what we're telling them about the Martians having come to the world. But we didn't know that it wasn't a few people. It was, in fact, nationwide. I had no idea that I'd suddenly become a sort of national event. And it was immediately after our show went off the air that Walter Winchell, who was on a rival network and had heard about how all the telephone lines had been jammed and all the excitement was going on, went on the air on his network, on his program of news commentary, and said, "Mr. and Mrs. America, there is no cause for alarm. America has not fallen. I repeat, America has not fallen." Of course, that was really enough for that network, and by that time there wasn't a phone you could get to really anywhere in the States. The highways were jammed with cars going one way or another. Those people who were in the cities were going to the hills, and those people who were in the hills were coming into the cities. I suppose we had it coming to us, because, in fact, we weren't as innocent as we meant to be. When we did the Martian broadcast, we were fed up with the way in which everything that came over this new magic box, the radio, was being swallowed. People, you know, do suspect what they read in the newspapers and what people tell them, but when the radio came, and I suppose now television, anything that came through that new machine was believed. So in a way, our broadcast was an assault on the credibility of that machine. We wanted people to understand that they shouldn't take any opinion predigested, and they shouldn't swallow everything that came through the tap, whether it was radio or not. But as I say, it was only a partial experiment. We had no idea the extent of the thing, and I certainly personally had no idea what it would mean to me.
Well, it's quite nice to hear Orson Welles there talking about his 1936 War of the Worlds broadcast, the book, of course, by H.G. Wells. Martin, he's saying there that actually it was a bit of a test that they were doing, that it was an assault on the credibility of radio. That was part of why they did what they did.
Well, yes, and it was a very interesting outcome, wasn't it? But on the other hand, in an extreme situation, that sort of gamesmanship would be unacceptable, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, for example, in World War II, if somebody had said, let's have a radio show that says that Hitler's already won and taken over in London and see what people do,
well, do you know
that
what?
Would have been regarded as treason,
well,
surely.
Well, maybe, but do you know what? Before CBS, or was it NBC in the States radio, did the War of the Worlds in the 30s, I think it was maybe late 1920s or early 1930s, the BBC did something exactly the same about the overthrow of Parliament. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
They did a broadcast in this country, and apparently it was on a cold winter's day where newspapers hadn't managed to get through. And so people believed it. People believed it in this country too. So it's quite clear that the experimentation around broadcasting, as there's been a lot of people with their fingers in the pie saying, well, maybe we can use this for something. Maybe we can... Well, let's test to see how much people believe it. And that's definitely the case, that there was a much more of a lack of trust in the press. People kind of know a newspaper might be lying. But when you see someone's face, hear their voice, the idea of broadcasting was it's going to be much more believed than the old newspapers were.
Well, I mean, I remember the first televisions, so I remember what that was like. And, of course, there was only one channel at that stage, so it really was quite authoritative, you know. And there's only one lot of things to watch, so that's what people watched. What we've got now is a rather different situation, with everybody got a mobile phone. So we've now got multiple experiments in what people will believe circulating in real time, and not everybody's got their own personal AI bot that's programming them, because it follows your interests and knows what to tell you in order to make you believe things.
Well, one of the things I've noticed over the last couple of years, particularly the last few months or month even, is that we're getting more and more Americans on the BBC as presenters, as interviewees. Much of the BBC's international coverage on the World Service and even on the domestic channels is about the United States and by Americans. So you get American accent interviewing American accent on the BBC now.
Yeah, it reminds me of that old Clash song, I'm so bored with the USA. Remember that one?
I do, I certainly do, yes. But it's, you know, this is the point, isn't it, that the Americans seem to be moving in, don't they? Whether it's to do with our local politics, bringing in mayors all over the place.
Peter Thiel owning the whole of the NHS's data set.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the country's up for sale, and America is buying, I guess. BlackRock buying up our farmland.
That's right. It'll be interesting to see which way the government jumps when we're asked to go to war with Iran. Of course, we've already participated. As far as the Iranians are concerned, we're already participating. They know that they've been refueling. Of course, they...
You just want to say something about the refueling planes?
Yeah. Well, God, the Americans have been refueling the Israeli planes as they've been attacking Iran. So from the Iranian point of view, they're already co-belligerent.
They're getting as close as they possibly can to the front line doing the actual killing. But they're helping as much as they can.
Yes. So in other words, from the Iranian point of view, if I was an Iranian general, I'd say stop talking to them now. We've got to prepare to fight them.
So why is Trump delaying getting involved for 2 weeks now? He said 60 days.
He said up to 2 weeks.
I will decide on the bombing Iran in 2 weeks, apparently. No, up to 2 weeks,
up
is
to
it?
Up to 2 weeks.
So that could be this weekend.
That could
weekend.
Be right now this
Didn't
minute.
Cy Hirsch come up with a piece? I don't know if you saw
that. Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, what do you... Cy's pretty on...
Well, he says that they're definitely going to attack. So if I was the Iranian general staff or the Russian general staff, I would presume that they are going to attack and we're going to have to fight them.
If Iran's Fordo plant, which is used for enriching uranium, is to be destroyed, the Pentagon is saying the United States will need a nuclear weapon.
Yep.
Tactical nuke or...?
Well, it'll have to be big enough to destroy Fordo.
Megaton nuke?
Well, enough. It'll be a use of a nuclear weapon. And, of course, that will... the Pakistanis have already said if... Israel or anybody uses nuclear weapons, then Israel is going to be vaporized. Now, they may be bluffing. We shouldn't be here. None of this should be happening. there was a deal on the table in 2015.
There seems to be a lot of bluffing going on, and we don't know if they're bluffing or not, but it's a stupid thing to say. I mean, isn't the fact that the people with their hands on the weapons and the control of the political system, the financial system, they can just simply decide to do what they want to do and stuff everybody else. And if it's a nuke, it's a nuke. So what are you going to do about it?
Well, as Thucydides or Thucydides said in his Peloponnesian War, the strong do what they wish and the weak must suffer what they must, because that's politics. But of course, don't be a loser.
Is there going to be any kind of division between Democrats and the Republicans over this in the States?
It doesn't look like it. I was saying earlier, there's 36 senators, no, Congress people who've put forward a, because of course, Trump doesn't, the courts have decided that he doesn't have the power to impose tariffs. He's now disputing that. And the president definitely doesn't. It's explicit in the Constitution. He does not have the right to go to war without a vote in Congress. So some people are saying, well, why can't we have a vote in Congress? But I'm afraid the majority of legislators in the US are paid, you know, their funds for getting elected come from Zionist billionaires and others similar. So they cannot oppose, even though 60% of the population in the US are opposed, and less than 20% are in favour. The rest don't know. So what will happen is the US is going to go to war on behalf of the Israelis against Iran with the support of a tiny proportion of its own population, and Britain will join in, even though most of the population here don't want to join in. Many people are not really interested in it. Why are we getting involved in this? And others who know more about it are opposed to it because they're opposed to it, like these Palestine activists, which I sent you the stuff earlier, who've attacked the
air. They managed to get into
Brize Norton and damaged some RAF planes.
There were a few helicopters flying in that direction earlier on, very low. Yes. Army helicopters.
Well,
maybe.
I mean, people say they shouldn't be doing that, and I'll say, well, the RAF shouldn't be helping the Israelis to kill children.
No, of course they shouldn't. In fact, apparently our Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is a human rights lawyer, knows all about international law. Anyway, let's move to look at Gaza now, because for me, much of what's been going on with Iran could be saber-rattling, but it certainly is a distraction from what's been happening in Gaza. If there is any kind of a nuclear program to get rid of, that's very much in doubt, as we know from the IAEA and also from the National Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. So what has been going on in Gaza? Well, on Sky News, there's a lady on there, Nadia Sawa, I think is her name. She had this to say.
So the first thing to say about this is that it's absolutely shameful that the only story we have about Gaza on tomorrow's front pages is about pro-Gaza protests in the UK. We have, a few days ago, an Israeli parliamentarian said on Israeli media, he said, we can do what we want. I'm paraphrasing. Nobody cares. We can kill 100 Palestinians in Gaza over one night, which has been happening with frequency, and nobody cares anymore. The world will just let us do it. And it seems that our media are determined to prove him right, because for weeks now, that is exactly what we've had. We've had a UK surgeon who's working out of a hospital in Gaza. He's been giving interviews and saying, this is what it's like. It's 100 killed one night, 150 killed another night, 75 another night. He says, this is a slaughterhouse. This is like being in a slaughterhouse. We have seen the Israeli government absolutely say the quiet part out loud, that what they're doing is ethnic cleansing in Gaza. And we are not covering it. It is not on the front pages of our newspapers. And that in itself is a disgrace. And that is what allows it to keep going on.
Okay, I mean, there have been statements, strongest straight statements ever from Keir Starmer and other European leaders, obviously.
Statements, but not action. Israel doesn't care about statements. The Israeli government, which is the most extreme government that Israel has ever had, and is saying out loud, we're going to corral Palestinians in Gaza, basically into a concentration camp in a little bit of the strip, and we're going to take over the rest. And is starving and slaughtering people on a daily basis. It does not care that Canada, France and the UK says, well, if you carry on doing this, we're going to do something terrible. We need to be actually taking action now, today. action that Israel will be forced, compelled to listen to and stop. Everything else is meaningless and is allowing this to continue. We have
Nadia Sawala from Wandsworth.
I'm sure to say that didn't sound like she's from Gaza.
No, it's not from Gaza. Right. That is about Gaza. And there she is talking about on Sky News, on their news review, saying, looking at the newspapers, saying, well, why is Gaza gone? Well, the obvious answer is because Iran is taking over from Gaza in the news. Meanwhile, every day, around about 100 Gazans who are starving, hungry, trying to get food, are being shot dead by the Israeli army.
This has been the plan all along. If they can get a general war going in the Middle East, the right wing in Israel have always thought that will be our opportunity to finish the Palestinians off while everybody's attention is on something else. So that's exactly what they're doing.
So she's talking there about the hospitals. Let's go to a Gaza hospital, shall we? I think this is again is a Sky report.
You talked about how difficult it was going to be leaving. Do you have an update, especially on some of the children that remain in those hospitals?
Yeah, we do have an update, and the main thing that's happened since we left is that Nasser has gone into the red zone. So it's actually now in an evacuation zone. Although the hospital hasn't been ordered to evacuate, the staff have to deconflict their journeys. So that means that they have to coordinate with the IDF to come in and out of the hospital. And that's had a real knock-on effect in the way that the hospital functions.
And for the patients that are within that hospital now that it is in the red zone?
So a lot evacuated themselves, all of the walking wounded that could leave left. But the real issue is that there are 48 patients in the intensive care unit, and none of the hospitals around Nasser have the capability to manage intensive care patients. It's of MSF Belgium, of ICRC, the Kuwait and the Jordanian cannot take ICU patients, and none of those field hospitals can generate oxygen. Nasser is the only hospital in the south of Gaza that has an oxygen station. It's also the only hospital that has a CT scanner and the only hospital that has a blood bank.
Dr. Rose, you warned before you left that one of the things that worried you is that if things get worse than what they are, and it seems like it has now that it's in the red zone, that there wouldn't be much to go back to. Is that the sense you still have?
I think for us it's very difficult for medical healthcare personnel to go back and not have a hospital to work in. There is very limited amounts of aid we can offer from a field hospital. The field hospitals are not designed to give trauma care. They're designed as triage centres. So if there are no left standing hospitals in Gaza, we are very limited in what we can offer the population.
And Dr. Rose, is there anything that you would urge the British government to do at this point? We saw there in the piece, the fact that they've just been so few people, so few children that have been evacuated out of the country and out of the territory, and that is one of the issues.
Well, there is a lot we can do. I think the evacuation of children is possibly the most important, particularly now that COGAT seems to be allowing more children to leave. And definitely the UK, which has only taken two children, does need to step up and accept more, like the rest of its European compadres. The other thing that we can do is continually put pressure on Israel. This is a human rights issue, and they cannot take out the last standing hospital in Gaza. There's a lot of work being done by our Jewish colleagues in Israel now to try and lobby the government to get the IDF to move away from this area. And I think anything that we can do to support that would mean that the healthcare system in Gaza will not completely collapse.
So that's Dr. Rose. Actual name is Dr. Victoria Rose, and she and Tom Pottercar have done an amazing little film for Sky News, which is called, it's a 28 minute documentary called Doctors on the Frontline, Martin.
Well, obviously I agree with all of that.
Horror show, basically.
Well, it is, and of course, it's the precursor to further horrors as we move into the second half of 2025.
What about the relationship with Iran, though? Because this is all getting really nasty and very, very bad in Gaza, isn't it? That seems obvious to me that they don't want anyone focusing on what's happening to the poor Gazans.
They don't, and as I say, the plan has always been to have a general war in the Middle East, particularly with the Americans and the British involved to help the Israelis, and that then, of course, people in Britain will be really, really upset about those RAF people who died in Akrotiri. Because, of course, you remember the old Irish Republican news cartoon joke, Cormac, about the relative importance of the dead? 10,000 Bangladeshis equals 100, British soldiers equals one, whatever it is, yeah? And, of course, that's, you know, the dead children of Gaza are just a detail now, but a dead RAF person, that is going to make people cry.
Lady was saying, Nadia, was saying is the Israelis don't care. I mean, they can do this with impunity. They can get away with it. They know they can.
Well, what they may find out over the next 48 hours, that being an Israeli soldier is a very unfortunate choice, because you're going to be in your barracks and a bunker buster is coming in on your head, and I'm afraid your children are going to cry when you die.
Randy Fine is a Republican congressman. We heard earlier on from Ted Cruz. I was going to say Tom Cruise, but no, Ted Cruz, the Republican senator from Christian Zionist from Texas. And we've got another Christian Zionist. I think this guy must be now, by the way he talks. He's from Florida. He's a Republican congressman from Florida. Randy Fine, also known as Duke Nukem.
The fact of the matter is the Palestinian cause is an evil one.
Yeah, and Congressman, there is a ceasefire deal on the table right now that the White House is hoping both Israel and Hamas will sign on to. Does this shooting change anything when it comes to the course of the war or the negotiations to end it?
Well, I think it speaks to the importance of the only end of the conflict is complete and total surrender by those who support Muslim terror. In World War II, we did not negotiate a surrender with the Nazis. We did not negotiate a surrender with the Japanese. We nuked the Japanese twice in order to get unconditional surrender. That needs to be the same here. There is something deeply, deeply wrong with this culture, and it needs to be defeated.
Well, it's a bit of an extreme culture war, isn't it, when you don't like someone else's culture, so you decide you're going to nuke them?
Yep. All Muslims need to be nuked. That's basically what he's saying. Because there's no point trying to reason with them or discuss anything with them. Their culture is basically the problem. So, you know, we've got to get rid of them, because they're not going to change their culture. So we just need to
let's just be clear about this kind of religious fanaticism, fundamentalism. They don't get called... Christian Zionists like him don't get called fundamentalists, do they? That fundamentalism is a term which is only for Muslims, not for Jews or Christians.
Well, indeed. And, of course, the twisting of language to other people you don't like is a universal thing that's been going on forever, really, but it's still reprehensible. Of course it is.
Well, anyway, we got the latest from Fatima this week from northern Gaza. She has this to say. I mean, obviously she's focusing mostly on the situation with food there. It's absolutely horrendous, and it's one of the obviously major concerns of everybody. They don't want to starve.
Hi, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of a freedom in northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. The most live-streaming issue in Gaza today is the Israel-American aid distribution model, which has become a symbol of both humiliation and danger for Palestinians. Despite the global awareness of the deadly conditions surrounding these centers, the international community remains largely inactive. Western governments frequently advocate for democracy and human rights, yet their actions regarding Palestine contradict these values. While calling for justice elsewhere, they continue to arm the Israel occupation and turn a blind eye to the massacres committed against Palestinian civilians. In Gaza, even the basic human right to food is being brutally denied. The famine is sweeping the enclave, and unarmed Palestinian civilians seeking aid often returned to their families in body bags. For months, Israel occupation has maintained a total blockade on Gaza, cutting off access to food, water, fuel, and essential aid. This siege has resulted in widespread hunger, acute malnutrition, and increasing deaths from starvation, especially among children. Aid distribution, instead of being a lifeline, now comes with the risk of being shot or bombed. True humanitarian aid must be distributed safely, at scale, and under the supervision of the United Nations, including UNRWA. Israel's ongoing crimes, blockade, airstrikes, and denial of aid are part of a broader pattern of impunity from Gaza to the West Bank, and even through bombings in different parts of the Arab world, Israel operates without accountability. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is so catastrophic. Hospitals and sanitation systems are near collapse. Over 60% of the homes and 68% of roads have been destroyed, and sewage floods the street, heightening health risks. Thank you.
So as Fatima again, actually in Gaza, and I will put up a link to Doctors on the Front Line from Victoria Rose and Tom Policar, who are doctors over in Gaza. Everyone's supposed to be forgetting about Gaza. No, we're not on this show. Absolutely not, Martin, are we?
No, and I think actually a lot of younger people are interpreting this business with Iran as very much in this context. So we shall have
to
see.
You mean young people here, or what do you mean?
Well, I mean young people around the world, but in this country particularly, you know, they can see that what you're saying, that they're attacking Iran because they want to divert attention from what they're doing.
This whole idea of control of the press, which is what Orson Welles was referring to, and Afshin Ratanzi were referring to, and we've been referring to, is it going to work?
Well, look, I mean, the people engage in these propaganda stunts and warfare, war-making and psychological warfare, because they want to achieve results that they want to achieve. And they wouldn't bother if they didn't think they could achieve something by doing these things. So that's what happens.
Well, one piece of news this week, which is a domestic national story, which has come out just the same day, in fact, just an hour, a couple of hours before the Iranian TV station was bombed on Monday, is the announcement that Keir Starmer and the British government is going to have another inquiry into what they say grooming gangs. We call it child prostitution. Do you think this can, before we hear from former policeman John Wedger talking about this, Martin, do you think we need another inquiry?
Well, I think the woman who was in charge of the first inquiry, who previously said, well, they haven't actually...
That's Alexis J.
Yeah, they haven't actually implemented the things I recommended last time round, but she's now saying, OK, if we're going to have another one, let's have another one, but let's actually do the things we need to do rather than talk...
It's one major problem.
Not just have an inquiry.
One
inquiry is an inquiry. You'd have to do stuff, you know.
Major problem with all of this is the Home Office is doing the inquiry. The Home Office is megally implicated in the child sexual abuse scandals, not only through MI5, Kinkora and other things which come under the auspices of the Home Office, but also through the police complete inaction in many cases with child prostitution being reported and not investigating. Well, one person that did investigate is Detective Constable X John Wedger.
A meeting with a guy who was a senior social worker, and he was the one who actually brought the Elm guest house list to light. He compiled it along with Mary Moss. And this fellow, I sat down with, had a long chat with him one day, and I said, you know, what gets me about the intelligence services? Why do the intelligence services not any sort of information, intel reports or documentation, which will clearly show one of their own, or, you know, or those involved high up, are paedophiles? Why don't they do what we used to do in the police and burn it, right? I'm not saying I ever did that, but it was a practice that went on. They would burn the paperwork. It was called a midnight barbecue, so there was no trace of it ever, right? And if you throw it away, it could end up on a landfill site or anything. If you burn it, you got nothing. And he said, no, the intelligence services don't do it because, for one reason, because it has massive blackmail value.
Wow. So, I mean, I wondered, looking at our current cabinet, for example. You know, there is all sorts of pressure being put on in Britain now to support the genocide in Israel start what could be eventually a third world war, possibly even a nuclear war with Iran. And it could be that we've got people sitting there making these decisions and actually someone's pointing a gun to their head, John.
Yeah, may well be. The whole thing is dirty, the stakes are high, and you're going to get espionage. And, you know, anyone who's ever watched a James Bond film has always seen that it's always been, you know, these sexual decoys that have been used, whether it be spying or whatever. I mean, Ian Fleming, the one who actually wrote James Bond, he's an interesting character because he was a naval intelligence officer during the war. And he used prostitutes as his officers, as his covert operatives. And they were one of the most successful covert units in the Second World War. You know, so you've only got to sort of look at someone's weakness and prey on that, and you've got them. You've got them, and especially if they've come from, you know, these residential elite boys' schools such as Eton and Winchester, where the fagging system was well underway and beatings and buggery were commonplace, you know, amongst the adolescent young boys, you know, under this fagging system. And, of course, you start taking part in them practices or having them pushed on you, it's going to cause a lot of physical damage and emotional distress and emotional harm, which you'll carry through into your adult life. And, you know, and that's why you will get these cold-hearted leaders that care not for the other side, with lack compassion and empathy, because they've gone through the beatings and the buggery. But it also may mean that they have a propensity as well to do that to others. And that's why you've got these politicians and high-up businessmen that were using the services of rent boys, especially from the meatpack in Piccadilly. And if anyone ever reads Anthony Daly's book Playland, that, you know, that's more than evident in that book.
Now, you mentioned the idea of prosecution through the National Crime Agency or even a special unit there, an investigation, a proper investigation. Now, this is a relatively recent thing. I have interviewed Anthony Stansfield recently, who was absolutely damning of them, saying that even though they're presented with massive evidence of literally up to £1 trillion in fraud being carried out by, well, it was originally HBOS, which did get prosecuted, and then now apparently it's Lloyds Bank doing this, that forgery of signatures by the bank, this sort of thing. But they're just failing to do anything about it. And I wonder if this agency is even fit for purpose, a National Crime Agency. Maybe they are the criminals themselves. We are the crime, you know, rather than actually investigating it.
I know that Anthony Stansfield is the crime commissioner for Thames Valley, I think. Last time. I've been before him, and I've relayed all this information to him, you know. So it's not as if he doesn't know about it, hasn't been told. I mean, it's all right dealing with sort of like financial chicanery in Hong Kong and places like that, which I think is where he did that inquiry. But, you know, let's step this down a little bit. We're talking about little kids from care homes that are being used by the elites for the most sadistic and horrific sexual games.
No, I mean, Anthony's point was the National Crime Agency is modelled apparently on the FBI, saying it's ineffective, it's totally not fit for purpose. So maybe you can explain the old system, what was around, I suppose, before the National Crime Agency, because that did seem to work from time to time.
It's easy to remedy, and I gave a remedy in my presentation to the ICSA inquiry, right? It's easy to do so. Look, surveillance can be incredibly expensive and time-consuming, and especially dealing with kids, you start looking at having to use child informants and things like that. It's very dangerous and very messy. But it doesn't need to be that complicated. All you need to do is compel the care home workers. This is where the missing person teams at the police have don't do their job properly, because all they do is push paper about, you know, but when a kid goes missing, they should be debriefing the child. They should be linking in with a care home. So every time a kid goes missing, the care home worker is diligent and goes out and does some very discreet inquiries and gets the registration of the vehicle that picks the child up. That can then be relayed to, you need proactivity to a proactive fast response unit like I was on, and we go and get that car, the registered keeper, we sit up on it and wait. Now, there's an offence. If you expect that child then to give up this guy who picks her up, who she probably classes as her boyfriend, he's just a Romeo for an organised crime network, but, you know, these are young, vulnerable girls, teenage girls as well. So all you do, you don't need the kid's compliance to do this, because you probably ain't going to get it anyway. There's an offence that says that anyone that picks up a child who's subject to a care order, right, away from their place of residence at an unsocial hour. Now, anything after 9 o'clock is classed as unsocial. You just jump on the guy, right? You jump on the guy, you hit him hard, and because it's what's called an arrestable offence, it's not just an offence, it's an arrestable offence, it gives you the power to detain and to seize and to search. So from that, you can then search the vehicle, seize his phone, and then go round and search his home as well. And on there, you are going to find an audit trail, and it will usually be in the form of a text message between that guy and the young girl. And that's it. Case complete. Right? You've got it. You've got it in a nutshell. And then from there, you get that guy who's usually, when I dealt with it, was an asylum seeker. Right? And then from there, you link him with the Home Office, everyone else. You try and get a revocation order against their status. And definitely get them remanded in custody, and then put pressure on them to start grassing those higher up, which they near enough all used to do. And it's done. It is quick and easy to do. It's very cost effective, and it's incredibly effective. I gave them all this, how to work it, but it needs proactivity. And did they do it? No. And in fact, when I gave that presentation to a group of outreach workers, charity workers from two of the main kids' charities, from their safeguarding team and many other NGOs, I was then stopped and reported to a senior officer classed as treading on toes for proactive operations that were always already in place, which was a lie, because they weren't. And I was then shut down from dealing what I was dealing with, and no one else bothered to do it, and these kids continued to be pimped out.
Yeah.
So you don't, you're right, you don't need... See, this is the problem people have, right? And they're obsessed with rank. Right now, Anthony Stansfield was, I'm not knocking him at all, he was a retired, high-ranking British Army officer, and he's got himself this very high, convoluted job with the Crime Commissioner. But it matters not a jot who he knows, what commissioners he knows, what chief constable he knows. If they do sod all, he might as well know nothing. You know, you need hard-working, tough street coppers like I was, a little squad of them, that are prepared to go out there in all weathers and all times, and absolutely batter the daylights out of those pimping up the girls. And it's a start. And it will stop it. And from there, you absolutely hammer them and bully them, right? And the law allows for this, into giving information about those higher up the organised criminal network. And it's so doable, right? You don't need to go all the national and all this and all that. You keep it. There's an acronym, KISS. Keep it simple, stupid.
So that's John Wedger, former detective constable in the Metropolitan Police, talking about what really needs to happen, Martin. Of course, this inquiry is none of that. He's saying you need proactive policing, you need people on the job, that it's easy enough to do, and then you can also get them to turn Queen's evidence, or King's evidence, I suppose it is now, and grass up the people who are making the money out of this pimping. And it's all spelt out there, but they're not doing that, they're having another inquiry.
Well, that was the argument against having another inquiry in the first place. But, of course, what's happening now with the Labour government is that they're nicking reforms policies. Yeah? So that's what they... And it's not a good look, really. If you're going to have another inquiry, just have one. If you're not going to have one, decide not to have one. And what you're saying, of course, is the truth, which is what we actually need to do is have a system that stops it happening, not another inquiry to find out what is happening, because we know what's happening.
We know exactly what's happening. In fact, we've had another inquiry. We know exactly what's wrong. We've got corruption within the police, and we've also got corruption within social services. and within the judiciary. So what we need is just go and arrest the people, get the information, prosecute them. Come on, chief constables.
Yes, and of course, what he's talking about is the real Johns in this tend to be much higher up the social hierarchy than the ones in the Muslim grooming gangs. And that is why they don't do that, because it will be ex-police officers and judges and private school people, many of them, who will be the people behind all of this.
You're quite possibly right. Anyway, finally tonight, in terms of clips, we're going to have a listen, as I promised, to the Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz, Republican senator interview, who is apparently the real big fighter for Israel in the US Congress, where they start to get into some of the spiritual, religious side of it and his Christian Zionism, why he does what he does for Israel. So Christian Zionism is, do you want to say anything about this, Martin? Because I think it's a heresy, basically. The idea is that whatever Israel does is God's will, isn't it? That's what they're saying.
It comes from the Scofield Bible, I understand, which has got its own sort of notes about what it's all about. And of course, the whole Zionist project wasn't originally a Jewish project. It was a project by Christian Zionists who thought it would be a good idea to have Jews back in the Holy Land for their own reasons.
And also, of course, secular Jews and Freemasons. And funnily enough, the same decade was this alleged letter from Albert Pike to Mazzini, which talked about World War I, the purpose of which was to clear the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine. World War II, the purpose of which was to create the State of Israel. And World War III, which was a massive conflagration between the Zionists and the Muslim world. So a bit of a coincidence that all seemed to happen in the 1870s at the same time. And that there were a bunch of Masons, because Albert Pike was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. But anyway, let's have a listen to Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson battling this one out.
The reason is twofold. Number one, as a Christian, growing up in Sunday school, I was taught from the Bible, those who bless Israel will be blessed, and those who curse Israel will be cursed. And from my perspective, I want to be on the blessing side of things.
Of those who bless the government of Israel?
Those who bless Israel is what it says. It doesn't say the government of, it says the nation of Israel. So that's in the Bible. As a Christian, I believe that.
Where is that?
I can find it to you. I don't have the scripture off the tip of mine. You pull out the phone and use the
Bible. It's in Genesis. But so you're quoting a Bible phrase. You don't have context for it. And you don't know where in the Bible it is, but that's like your theology. I'm confused. What does that even mean?
Tucker.
I'm a Christian. I want to know what you're talking about.
Okay. Where does my support for Israel come from? Number one, because biblically we're commanded to support Israel. But number two.
Hold on. You're a senator and now you're throwing out theology, and I am a Christian. And I am allowed to weigh in on this. We are commanded as Christians to support the government of Israel?
We are commanded to support Israel. And we're
what does
told,
that mean, Israel?
We're told those who bless Israel will be blessed.
But what? Hold on. Define Israel. This is important. Are you kidding? This is a majority Christian country.
Define Israel? Do you not know what Israel is? That would be the country you've asked like 49 questions about.
So that's what Genesis, that's what God is talking about.
The nation of Israel, yes.
And is that the current borders, the current leadership? He's talking about the political entity called Israel?
He's talking about the nation of Israel. Yeah, nations exist, and he's discussing a nation. A nation was the people of Israel.
Is the nation
the descendants
God's referring
of Abraham.
To in Genesis, is that the same as the country run by Benjamin Netanyahu right
yes.
now?
Yes, yes.
It is. Okay.
And by the way, it's not run by Benjamin Netanyahu as a dictator. It's a
I'm
democratic
not
country
he's a dictator.
That elected...
He's the prime minister,
right?
What?
But just like... You know, America is the country run by Donald Trump. No, actually, the American people elected Donald Trump. The same principle
is
there.
This is silly. I'm talking about the political entity of modern Israel.
Yes, and that is
you believe that's what God was talking about in Genesis.
I do, but
that country's existed since when?
For thousands of years. Now, there was a time when it didn't exist, and then it was recreated just over 70 years ago.
But I'm saying, I think most people understand that line in Genesis to refer to the Jewish people, God's chosen people.
That's not what it says.
Okay, Israel, but you don't even know where in the Bible it is, so I don't know.
I don't remember the scriptural citation. But, okay, I keep...
It's like Genesis 16 or something like that. But yes, it's in the earlier part of the book. But the point is...
All right, Tucker, you keep interrupting me before I finish my sentence.
No, it's just important to know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're... So you're saying as a Christian, if I believe in Jesus, I have to support the modern state of Israel?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm explaining for me what my vote motivation is.
But you, okay, so I'm just trying to understand. You said God tells you to support the modern state of Israel in the Bible, in some place in the Bible that you heard about, but you don't know where it is. That's your theology?
You're going back, am I a sleazy feline again? I mean,
if you accuse me of anti-Semitism again, I will say that, but I don't think you will.
Try to be a little less condescending. I'm trying to have a conversation.
You're condescending. You're throwing this stuff out, and it's my job to figure out what you're talking about, okay, but, and I don't understand.
But you're not letting me.
Okay. I'm sorry. I want to be polite.
That is, for me, a personal motivation, but I also, what I was about to say, I don't believe my personal faith, not everyone who I represent is a Christian, it's not an argument for me to give that we should do this because of my faith. And so as an elected official, I don't give that as the reason we should support Israel. That is a personal motivation for me, but I don't think it is the reason we should. The reason that I am the leading defender of Israel is because Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East, an incredibly troubled part of the world, and supporting Israel benefits America. And the clearest illustration of that is what is happening right now. Let me just make this point, and then,
okay. And then I'll just ask what you mean. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. Look, Iran, I think the most acute national security threat facing America right now is the threat of a nuclear Iran. I think China is the biggest long-term threat, but acute and near-term is a nuclear Iran.
Okay.
And I think Israel is doing a massive favor to America right now by trying to take out Iran's nuclear capacity.
Well, I mean, the delusion of what's the name of the guy?
Ted Cruz.
Is that Ted Cruz again?
Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson.
All right, yeah, that's all right. Okay,
well, it's a two-hour-long interview. It's actually stupendous to hear an anti-Christian and a Christian battling away over some.
Well, he would say he is a Christian, Tony.
Well, of course he would. Yeah, of course he would.
Well, he would, yes. Well, I mean, obviously, when you think that we're dealing with genocide, starvation of children, potential nuclear war, I really don't want to have it based on what somebody wrote in
the Bronze Age. That's exactly what Tucker Carlson is saying.
Yeah.
And at the end of there, he says, not only do I think that God blesses those that bless Israel and curses those that curse Israel, he's also saying, well, okay, put that aside. It's also a really good idea to destroy Iran because it's trying to develop nuclear weapons.
Well, Iran isn't trying to develop nuclear weapons, as the intelligence services
say.
And
as he says in the interview, also they've made several attempts to assassinate President Trump.
Well, that is rubbish, but there you are. People believe what they want to believe, don't they? One thing is, I will say about that, those who believe what they want to believe are unlikely to win a war, because war requires actually very, very clear understanding of what's actually happening so you don't make mistakes. If you actually convince yourself of loads of things that aren't true, you are likely to lose. Let's hope so.
What about the British? Are we complicit in all of this? It looks like we might be. Nicaragua is taking Germany, Canada, the UK and the Netherlands to the International Court of Justice for supporting genocide.
It's quite clear that the British state is complicit, and therefore those in charge could, in fact, be charged. And I think that is the legal advice that they've been given, which is why they're starting to panic a bit and trying to create a bit of space between them and the regime in Israel. This is going to come to a head very, very quickly. By the time we're talking next week, Tony, RAF personnel in Akrotiri could be dead. And then we'll have to decide whether we're going to carry on down that road or not.
Well, the former ambassador Craig Murray has brought this up. He says in his latest piece, Starmer and Lammy are terrified. He's noticed that the UK government included some clause in the British ambassador to the UN stated this. This is one little clause that they added in. He said, while the UK voted in favour of this resolution at the UN, we wish to clarify that our long-standing position remains. There is no legal obligation on states to ensure respect for international law by third parties. Well, Craig Murray points out, oh dear matey, you've signed up to all these treaties. Yes, there is. So that's what he's saying is that they're actually getting a bit worried that maybe they're going to jail.
Yes, and also, of course, let's bring it back to a sort of boring level. They might lose the next election. And, of course, we didn't mention to our reform friends Nigel Farage going along to the Israeli birthday party at the at the British Museum. And, of course, he is going to have to jump off the fence one way or another as we go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis and the Americans happy. I hope he jumps the right way, because if he doesn't, that may be his chance of being Prime Minister down the toilet, eh?
Well, yeah, maybe. It's a little bit of a negative way to finish, Martin.
Well, I know, but I don't want reform to win the next election. I'm just wondering, they're going to have to answer that question, aren't they?
You want Keir Starmer too, do you?
No, I don't want Keir Starmer, but I don't...
Oh, you can't say that as a Labour Party member.
I can.
Can you?
Yes.
Who do you want, Jeremy Corbyn back?
What I want is probably the best result of the next election, like most elections in this country, will be a hung parliament where we can change the system. We never got to discussing changing the electoral system with our reform colleagues.
I love the way Craig teases out these little sections. While the UK voted in favour of this resolution, we wish to clarify our long-standing position remains. There is no legal obligation on states to ensure respect for international law by third parties. Sorry, there is.
I'm afraid there is. Somebody should tell Ratko Mladic and Slobodan Milosevic.
I thought that Keir Starmer was supposed to be a human rights lawyer.
Well, that's why he knows all the dodges to try and escape from responsibility.
You might be right. So we'll finish up with a short clip from him. This is Starmer himself during the Yugoslav wars in the 1990s, talking about... Do you know anything about a place called Vukovar, Martin?
Vukovar was a largely Serbian city inside Croatia. And when Croatia declared independence, they said, we don't want to be part of Croatia anymore. We're going to declare independence from you. So the Croatian army went into Vukovar on that basis, the same way the Croatian army went into Vukovar. Yeah. In the same way that the Ukrainian army went into the Donbass, but they got resistance.
Anyway, here's human rights lawyer who knows all the dodges, Sir Keir Starmer, our wonderful Prime Minister, speaking back in the 1990s about Vukovar.
The loss of life was extensive. The precise number will never be known, but estimates sit at about 1,100. Only 1,000 of the 9,000 family homes in Vukovar were left standing. Essential services, including electricity, water, and the sewage system, all failed. Wells were targeted and destroyed. In addition, much of the fabric of Vukovar's cultural, historic, and religious life was destroyed through the shelling of churches, schools, kindergartens, and public buildings. These findings reveal not an armed conflict directed at military objectives, but a radically disproportionate attack deliberately intended to devastate the town and its civilian population. This was almost certainly the most sustained attack on an urban area in Europe since the Second World War.
So, yeah, that's Starmer training to be an overthrower of human rights. I mean, on the opposite side of the courtroom.
Well, interestingly, Vukovar was very messy, but subsequently, of course, the Serbs were driven out of the Krajina, where they'd lived for 1,000 years. And I drove through the Krajina the next day. It was really, really sinister, because the whole place was empty. There was just a few stray dogs. And they'd all fled because the Croatian army had taken over and killed a few people and everybody else ran away. But those people aren't allowed to go back to where they came from. Because, of course, the whole idea of dividing Yugoslavia up into bits was bound to leave some people in the wrong bit. And that's what happened. And it wasn't just the Serbs who were doing nasty stuff to other people. So the Croatians were trying to kill all of the Muslims inside Mostar, where I went to quite a lot. And, of course, at the stage of the Srebrenica massacre, about 7,000 military-age males were executed. That's a war crime, no doubt about it. Was what Israel is doing now in... genocide is defined in law, and the guy who actually defined it in law after the Second World War, a Jewish guy, he says it's not just any old war crime, it's got to have all these other features to be genocide. I would argue that there wasn't really genocide in Yugoslavia. Loads of war crimes going on, but no real genocide. Ethnic cleansing, if you like, is a euphemism. It just means chasing people away. And so it's, you know, the idea of it's just cleaning up mess is actually, you know, it's actually offensive to use the phrase ethnic cleansing. So I'd say war crime, and then genocide is genocide. And there is clear rules about it. going back to the Nuremberg trials and all the rest of it. And I'm afraid the British state is on the wrong side, as is going to become clear
in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Is the Prime Minister going to end up in jail? Tony Blair didn't, did he?
No, but then on the other hand, he could end up being a decapitation strike, Tony, because that seems to be the mood of summer 2025 is decapitation strikes. Everybody's doing it, Tony. You just find the big guys on the other side and kill them and make their children cry. It's the future.
Well,
talk to the future, Tony.
Finally, talking about decapitation, Christian Today has got a piece this week. The UK Parliament's vote for abortion up to birth is absolute evil, they say. The culture of death in the UK is more deeply ingrained than I thought. For people who claim to be humanists, we seem to be killing humans a lot. As regards the church, it should be with one voice standing up and declaring that we will not go down the route of Baal or Molech, sacrificing our children to the idols of the contemporary West. We must speak out with a prophetic voice against this evil and warn with tears in our eyes of the judgment to come. One day these MPs will stand before a greater court than the Supreme Court and a higher judge than the electorate. Meanwhile, let us weep and mourn for today's post-Christian Britain. A Britain where you can get sent to jail for a tweet, but kill your own baby the day before she's born. A Britain where praying near an abortion centre is illegal, but killing a baby up to birth is legal. A Britain where God is mocked, his word abused, and humans destroyed. I can think of no better reaction than that of the psalmist in Psalm 136, I guess that is. Streams of tears flow from my eyes, for your law is not obeyed. So that's from Christian Today this week over the decision in Parliament to extend abortion rights up until birth. Anyway, it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to Richard Visick, and also to John Wedger. Thanks also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel. You can get everything you want on the show page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
So happy, I can see that same thing's happening here today. A show of strength with your boys' brigade. I'm so happy and you're so kind. You want more money, of course I don't mind. To my nuclear textbooks for atomic crimes. And the public gets what the public wants. But I want nothing, society's got. So I'm going underground. What if the first bass player start to pound? Going underground. Shout for tomorrow. Some people might get some pleasure out of hate me. I've been enough already on my plate. People might need some tension to relax me. I'm too busy dodging between the facts. You see, here's what you get. You made your bed, you better lie in it. You choose your leaders and place your trust. As their lies wash you down and their promises rust. You'll see killing machines with paper rockets and guns. And the public wants what the public gets. But I don't give up, the society wants. I'm going underground. Going underground. Well, the fast bands play a beat, start to pound. Going underground. Going underground. So let the boys all sing, or let the boys all shout for tomorrow. La 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 la. La 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 la. We're talking, I'm talking till my head explodes. I turn on the news and my body froze. It's playing cheap on my TV screen. But this boy shout, but this boy scream. Going underground.
Mm-hmm.